This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation listeners, I am so excited about what's happening right now because there's an ominous feeling in the air. You can feel the dread and the terror in the L-shaped studio because, ladies and gentlemen, my co-host Nick Duke and myself, the hard-traveling fanboys, can you feel the tension in the air? We're about to kick off Walking Dead Month at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. That's right, folks. For the third year, we are going to delve into the world of The Walking Dead, Robert Kirkman's brainchild. And in a show, in a comic book property that is so rooted in horror and terror, and one can argue terror to Nick and I for having to experience it all, we wanted to turn to a very special person that knows a lot about horror herself. We went straight to a person who's been joining us since the very first Walking Dead month. We went to the host of the Freak Out Drive-In. Yeah. We went to our good friend, co-host of Geek and Sassy, co-host of Talk and Pop, the Village Bicycle herself, Jenny Smith. Jenny, thank you for once again joining Nick and I for Walking Dead Month.
Well, thank you for having me again for the third year. I wouldn't miss this threesome for anything, I tell you what.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was an excellent, Hank Hill there at the end. I tell you what.
What?
Nick, we are here for Walking Dead Month. I mean, gosh, we've got Jenny here. We've got everything we need to kick this thing off right. Nick, what do you think about Walking Dead Month this year?
Well, I must say it's appropriate that it falls in October every year, seeing as how by this time of the football season, I am virtually a member of the Walking Dead at this point. And my physical feelings line up with that, because I feel like shit still. But that's okay. I'm here anyway. We're going to soldier through.
Shots. Everybody!
I regret nothing. That's not true. I regret many things.
You know, you didn't know this, Jenny, but I'm going to let you in and the listeners in on an exclusive. In the second half of the show today, I am going to unveil an exclusive interview with Nick Duke's liver.
Oh, God.
We're going to find out. We're going to find out exactly how it's doing, what its whereabouts have been.
Listen.
That poor son of a bitch.
Listen. I know you're looking for an excuse to bust out your Katharine Hepburn impression, but I would suggest that my liver is not the appropriate target for that.
Why would your liver be indiscriminately shouting, "Nah, man"?
Oh, hey, man. Hey, man. If you got subjected to some of the shit that it's been subjected to over the years, you know, God knows. That doctor that cut part of it out may have been named Norman for all I know. I don't fucking know.
Accepted in my head canon. There you go.
There you go. Turns Dr. out Norman, Duke, whatever.
Mr. What? Duke's blood is actually 89% alcohol at this point.
And the other 11% is chicken grease.
Chicken grease, baby. Hey, you know what? Dusty Rhodes lived a long and fruitful life with that being his, his is a little bit more weighted towards chicken grease, but, you know.
I'm pretty sure Ric Flair's blood is pretty much just scotch and cocaine at this point, so, I mean, yeah. What does that matter?
The Terry Funk scene from Beyond the Mat, but with Ric Flair's liver?
Yeah. Give it to me straight. You have no liver. It's just been squared away.
I've been working in the medical field for 40 years, and I can honestly tell you, I have never seen a liver disappear into a person before. But
the Thanos snap didn't take you entirely. It just took your liver.
Yeah, it is as if it's dissipated into your bloodstream. Fascinating. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Ric Flair's liver or even Nick's liver. We're here to talk about The Walking Dead. And you know what? With Jenny here, we reached out to her this year to see which one she wanted to join us for this month. And she wanted to kick things off with us with
Countdown. Of course, she didn't want to read any of this shit.
No, I did not want to read any of the shit. Or watch the premiere, even though I probably will.
Yes.
I don't know.
No one does want to read any of this shit. I certainly don't. But she wanted to join us for a countdown to celebrate The Walking Dead at its very best. Because, although we've been very cynical about it in the last, year or two, there was a time when all of us loved The Walking Dead, and it was one of our favorite shows on all of television. So we are here to count down the top five episodes of The Walking Dead, according to the only people that matter, the three of us. So, we are going to unveil our lists, and of course, at the end, we will give you the information of how you can unveil your lists to us, and we definitely want to hear those as well, even though they won't be as good as ours. So, with all that being said, let's get this thing started, and I guess there's no better place to start or no worse place to start than with me. So I will kick us off with my number five selection of the best Walking Dead episodes, and I am going to go to an episode titled Save the Last One. This is from all the way back in Season 2. It was Episode 3 of Season 2, and
This was on my preliminary list that I had to narrow it down
That's a good thing to mention, Nick, preliminary list. I had a huge preliminary list that I had to chop things down from. Mine was a little bit deeper than yours, actually. I was into the mid-20s, and I had to cut down and did so. But yeah, this comes to us, the third episode from Season 2. I worked this one on my list, and a spoiler alert, this will actually be the earliest episode that's on my list. Everything in my personal top five will be between seasons 2 and 5. And this was really an important episode in the progression of the show, because this kind of gives us, for the very first time on The Walking Dead, a firm villain for the show. Obviously, in season
one... I'm going to call bullshit on that.
What's your bullshit on?
You're going to say that this is the first time Shane is a legit villain on the show?
I'm going to say this solidified him as a villain, yes.
Not the attempted rape of Lori in season one.
The attempted rape of Lori. I don't remember that happening in season one. I thought that was season
two. It happened at the CDC... he came up to her after everybody had taken a shower and basically pressed her up against the wall and, like, held her up because she had been ignoring his advances ever since Rick had come back.
Oh, I thought that happened in Season 2 at the farm.
Nope, Season 1 at the CDC.
Hmm. Well, regardless, this was the way of regardless, there's no doubt that this episode establishes that Shane is changing, that Shane is turning into something of a an irrepressible monster. And the way that it does that is that we see Shane and the one of my favorite named characters on the show, Otis. As everyone knows, I have an affinity for characters named Otis. And, you know, Shane ends up – they go on a supply run to try to find these medical supplies necessary to save the best character on the show, Carl. And – In the midst of doing this, they just get overrun by walkers, and they're just in a lot of trouble. And as they're escaping, this horde of walkers are trying to escape. It becomes obvious to Shane and Otis that they're not going to make it out of there, that both of them can't make it. And so Shane makes a decision, and he decides that the survival of Carl is more important than the survival of this complete stranger. And he shoots Otis in the leg and leaves him for dead to distract the walkers while Shane escapes medical supplies. I'm a big fan of the Walking Dead episodes that tackle, a lot of them tackle themes, a lot of them tackle difficult questions, but the ones that tackle the questions in a compelling manner and establish the differences between these characters. And it right straight up front puts Shane in a situation where he does something Rick would never have done. At least at this point in the series, Rick Grimes would not have found it in his abilities to leave someone for dead, to do something so heinous just to ensure the survival of someone that he's close to. Shane is willing to cross that line. Shane is willing to make the very, very difficult choices that no one else wants to make, and this establishes that. It also features a horribly creepy and awesome performance from John Bernthal as Shane, who had already become my favorite character on the show at that point. And he comes back. I remember my favorite shot of the episode is a closing scene when he's told everybody, all we know as viewers is that he came back with the medical supplies and Otis didn't make it. And he tells them that Otis just got overrun and couldn't make it. And then we're revealed in flashback. It's revealed to us in flashback that Shane actually took him out, basically. And then you see that shot of Shane shaving his head and trying to get rid of the evidence, basically, from where Otis had attacked him and pulled a piece of his hair out when they had a brief, a scuffle. So, to me, this episode was really important for giving us our first serial villain in The Walking Dead, where it is, and establishing, again, some of the themes that would come back years later that would influence Rick, of Shane making decisions that are amoral, but that you can justify, because there is a justification for what Shane did, even if you don't agree with it, and even if it is objectively wrong. And I think part of it is also bringing Otis full circle from being the one that shot Carl. Now, I'm sure in Shane's mind, it's something of a payback for that. You also have some really good stuff here as Andrea and Daryl are looking for Sophia. It's the first time we're starting to get humanization for Daryl, who was kind of a bit of a non-factor in the first season, quite honestly. And then here in the second season is where Daryl is really getting a character. He's really getting to dig his teeth in and end up becoming my favorite character on the show, replacing Shane. So there's good stuff with them, good stuff with Carol, and also T-Dog exists. So there's that. So that's my episode for number 5, Save the Last One.
Your endless defenses of Shane will never fly with me, sir. Will never fly with me.
Endless defenses? I was just saying he was a complicated character.
He was a douchebag. That's pretty simple.
Well, everyone in The Walking Dead is a douchebag.
Except for Dale.
They have to be. They have except to be, or Dale. They die. Except who?
For Dale. Dale. Dale was no douchebag.
Dale
he was the
an
conscience.
Douchebag.
He was the conscience
Dale
of the
group.
Dale
was the biggest douchebag in The Walking Dead. And you know what was even bigger douchebag?
Dale never tried to rape anyone, Greg.
We don't know that.
Dale never went behind his best friend's back and slept with his wife.
Have you read the comics? Dale has sex with Andrea and presumably...
Dale gets around. Dale's doing very well for himself in the comics.
Dale,
good for Dale.
Dale's eyebrows are maybe not douchebags, but Dale himself, absolute douchebag.
Dale's eyebrows could probably give a woman pleasure.
Dale's very agile, very flexible. And they can go in different directions.
I've heard of a mustache ride, but an eyebrow ride.
Oh, come on, baby. You don't know what you're like until you've had one of those.
God,
Eugene Levy must just have an incredible sex life.
Oh, God.
Anyway, that was my number 5 selection. What's yours, Nick?
Oh, man, my number 5 selection. Okay. It's also from season 2, but it's from a few episodes after yours, Greg. It is the episode entitled Pretty Much Dead Already. This was actually the show's first mid-season finale, because if you remember, season 1 was only 6 episodes. There was no mid-season finale in season 1. But Pretty Much Dead Already was the episode where we got the big reveal of what was actually going on in the barn. We had found out in the episode previous, Glenn had made that discovery, and he had filled the rest of the group in here, and this episode revolves entirely around what to do with that information. Shane is obviously coming down on the side of it's a threat to everyone. We've got to bust into the barn. We've got to clear it out. Mm-hmm. Rick is trying to be a bit more
diplomatic. He's right, by the way.
He's not saying he's not right. But Rick is trying to be more diplomatic about it because it's not their place. It's not their property. He is trying to give some leeway to the owner of the property, who has done them a lot of good, by the way, mm-hmm. helping his son get better and all that.
Teaching them how to stare at pastures.
Now, that would become very valuable during the farmer Rick era.
Yes, it would.
It's, you know, everybody needs a good pasture stare.
Now, Rick, look at that pasture. Imagine all that grass was people. And imagine the people were standing on grass. And then imagine that grass had other grass underneath it, Rick.
And then Rick's walked off already, and Herschel's just talking to no one.
In addition to this, though, it also has a pretty big revelation as Shane is finally informed that Lori is pregnant, and that will kind of set up another element in his continuing mental spiral for the second half of the second season. But it all culminates, obviously, in Rick's and Shane's conflict that ends with Shane forcefully shooting open the door to the barn, letting the walkers out, and they begin to gun down these people who were Herschel's friends and family who had lived nearby, as Herschel is devastated, obviously. But that isn't enough, because the last walker to come out of the barn is Sophia, the walker, the young child of Carol they've been looking for the entire season to this point, who had really kicked off all the action that put him on the road to the second season. You know, she had ran away from or gotten separated from the group. Carl had gone looking for her. Carl gets shot. All the series of events was because of her disappearance, and now we find out she's been in the barn virtually the entire time. And that's how it ends, with Rick being forced to put Sophia down, put a bullet between her eyes. And that's how we leave The Walking Dead for its first mid-season finale, in between the first half of season two and the second half. So mid-season finales have become a pretty big thing for the show, and it's hard to argue that they may not have done one as well as this one in all the mid-season finales since.
Yeah, this was my last cut down, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually is my number five as well. So
there you go.
Oh, great. Go right into it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that stands out the most for me is Carol's reaction to seeing Sophia come out of the barn. It's heartbreaking. And she just falls apart, you know. She tries to go to her, and they have to hold her back, and then she has to watch her get shot right in front of her. I mean, it's just, it's devastating and amazing. Melissa McBride just, you know, even, you know, that just is pretty much the beginning of her character's complete turnaround, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is the one where there's the scene in the woods with Shane and Dale,
mm-hmm.
where they're going hunting. Is that right? And then, like,
yes, I think so. Like, and
Dale notices Shane turning the gun on
Rick. The gun on Rick.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that little subterfuge his there.
Yes, and his eyebrows furrow.
Yeah, I really like that scene. Do. And then Carl, you know, is he still healthy now at this point, or is he?
He's still on the road to recovery, I think. He isn't quite back yet.
I feel like he did something stupid in that episode, but...
One of the many roads to recovery Carl would be on. Right. The kid can survive fucking everything under the sun, you know. That's the biggest flaw. I mean, Otis really deserved to die, seeing as how he couldn't finish that fucker off when he had the chance.
So much Carl hate still from you. I mean, are you not satisfied by now?
No.
I feel like Nick needs to see a counselor about this.
Nope. Nope.
Did Carl ruin your life in some way?
Yeah, that stupid haircut. That's what did it.
Oh, well, he's dead now, so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, he's finished. He's dead now until he, what could he show up in to ruin Nick some more? I'm hoping that Chandler Riggs will join the cast of, I don't know.
He'll be Harry Osborn in the Spider-Man movie.
Yes! Oh, that would be so beautiful. That would be so beautiful. Oh, that would be, I really want that to happen now, Nick. You've planted the seed.
You know how Greg likes it when you plant your seed.
I do. One of my favorite stories about.
And then you'll be equally mad because he won't have basketball hair. He'll have stupid long hipster douchebag.
Oh no, I'll be okay with it because it will bring you great pain.
Mm. Fair enough.
Yeah, this is a great episode to put on there, both of you. This was my last cut, or one of my last cut downs. An incredible, the first in a series of incredible mid-season finales, because it sets that trend that The Walking Dead, to me, often struggles with their premieres and their finales, but they never struggle with their mid-season finales. And they've delivered some true classics over the years, and this was the first and maybe the best of those mid-season finales. Well, maybe not. We'll get to that a little bit later, but it was excellent. And really, the defining moment, I still think, the defining moment in Carol's life, because from that moment on, Carol.
I think. I would make an argument. There's another one later on, but we'll talk about that later.
Sure. But I think it does all still go back to Sophia, and this is what really transforms Carol from the housewife that was kind of reserved and
abused
and still a victim, very much a victim, to after this, she goes on the road to becoming a totally different, maybe the most self-sustained character in all of The Walking Dead. So, yeah, a hugely important episode. Glad it made both of your lists. Well, I lied in my first bit there, because I said that I wouldn't have anything after season 5. Completely wrong, because I've got an episode from season 6.
Why did you lie to us, Greg?
Well, because I liked to lie. I like to hear people lose faith in me. It gives me joy. It was a Vince McMahon promo from 2003, I think. Anyway.
I know what episode this is, by the way. Go ahead.
Yes, it's an episode called Here's Not Here.
That's my painting.
Is it really your painting?
Yeah, it's my number 4 as well.
Wow. This was the 4th episode of the 6th season of The Walking Dead. And it focuses entirely on someone who is not a main cast member of The Walking Dead. This is our very first episode, and to this point only episode, that focuses entirely on the character of Morgan Jones. And I'm trying to really frame this episode because it was so different. And it was very divisive. I knew when we talked about it at work the day after it aired, several people in the newsroom at the Dothan Eagle were not happy with this episode. They found it boring. I loved it, obviously, because it's on my top 5 list. First of all, Lenny James, who plays Morgan, is one of the best actors on television. He is dynamite in every role he gets on every show he has. He was amazing on Human Target, which people should check out. He's amazing on his BBC shows that he does. He's just a great actor, and anytime he is anchoring an episode of something, it's going to be good. But in this case, it's trying to show us how Morgan went from the character who we had encountered 2 seasons prior that was broken, that was literally an insane person who had lost his mind due to the death of his son, and his failure to protect his son from his zombified wife, to what we have in the present day, which was a character who was a man of peace, a man who was calm, who had come to understand life and appreciate life in a way that he never had before. This is a flashback episode and shows us how Morgan encounters an individual known only as Eastman, who will completely change his life. He goes on this path of enlightenment. He starts out this crazed loner who is basically trying to take from this man, Eastman. But Eastman doesn't allow that, and he also doesn't kill him, even though he has the chance. He imprisons Morgan, and then tries to reason with him and tries to get him to understand his philosophy to life. It is one of the most philosophical episodes. It's one of the most peaceful episodes of The Walking Dead. There is conflict, don't get me wrong, but this is an episode about avoiding conflict, about the value of life on a show where life is devalued constantly. And it was so effective in the midst of a barrage of kind of depressing, you might say sucky depression episodes. And this one comes and kind of brings a little bit of hope back to The Walking Dead through the character of Morgan, brings an angel to sit on Rick's shoulder opposite all the devils on Rick's shoulder, and also gives us some really cool Batman Begins-style training sequences between Morgan and Eastman. One thing that The Walking Dead really has never struggled with when they choose to is to have good action, and they do have good action in this one when it happens. And ultimately, of course, as all Walking Dead episodes do, it ends in tragedy because yes, Eastman does get killed. However, even in the midst of that loss, there is a sense of hope and renewal because Morgan has been saved. Eastman, in some ways, sacrificed himself to save Morgan's soul. And it's a really powerful episode for me. It's one of the last episodes that just moved me emotionally in a major way. There were still some that came after that were good, but this was, I think this was only the second time they had ever done an episode like this that was focused on one particular cast member. Mm-hmm. And it was, in my opinion, maybe the most successful, certainly one of the most successful. And that's why it's number four on my list.
Yeah, a couple of things that you didn't mention. One, I want to throw a special shout out to John Carroll Lynch, who played Eastman in the episode. I remember him best, of course, as Arthur Lee Allen in David Fincher's Zodiac, the man who they eventually heavily implied was the Zodiac killer. I've always enjoyed him and pretty much everything I've ever seen him in, so it was cool to see him get here, a little bit more of a larger role in something that was, at this point, The Walking Dead was still huge, so that was cool. And also, surprisingly, the most emotional death in the episode next to Eastman was probably his goat, Tabitha.
When
the goat died, the whole subplot about Eastman trying to learn to make cheese and how he had defended this goat with his life. It was just, this whole bit was, it was great. It was nice to actually give us a reason for, badass Jedi Morgan. I needed a little bit of explanation for why that was a thing. And while, the idea of him being able to master the art of Aikido and the bow staff in the course of, what is implied to be a month or whatever, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch, but this is also a show where we've got Michonne running around with a samurai sword, so I'm willing to go with you there. So, yeah, this is all good.
And I would argue that after this episode, Jedi Knight Morgan should have lasted longer than it did.
Yes, they went back to crazy Morgan far too quickly.
Way too quick,
Not to get off on a tangent of what's frustrating about the show, but that, if anything about the show I think it's frustrating, it's not that they take the characters in different directions, is that they retread the same material with characters too often, because we had already seen crazy Morgan, and we had gotten over it and moved on to something new.
Mm-hmm.
No need to go back there again. A bit of trivia that I've seen on the Wikipedia page, Greg, this is only the second episode in the history of the show to feature only one main cast member, the first being Live Bait, which was a Governor flashback episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and very successful in that way. And, it made me an even bigger fan of the Morgan character than I already was. And we'll just have to see what other episodes pop up on our lists. Jenny,
I remember thinking during this episode that I didn't know if Eastman was a bad guy or a good guy in the beginning, because he seemed pretty fucking crazy. So I was like,
yes.
I just remember being real thrown off, and it took pretty much the whole episode before you're like, because he tells his story, and before you, okay, so he's not going to, do anything bad.
Oh, God. The first time, I mean, the first time I saw him, I was like, this guy's got to be an escaped cannibal or something from Terminus.
Because he looked like, you know, he
looked like somebody that was going to imprison him and eat him or something.
Yes, but that's exactly what I thought.
He looked like the Zodiac Killer.
Exactly.
Yes, he did look like the Zodiac Killer. So, like, yes, I think this is, I'm so glad you brought that up, Jane. That's a great point because it really challenges our expectations on a show where we have grown conditioned. Nick and I have talked about this. We've grown conditioned to not trust anyone.
Right.
Because in this universe, why would you literally trust anyone that you meet? Because everyone betrays you. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the thought here, was that he was a bad guy. And the fact that it kind of played your cynicism against you over the course of the episode, and was like, man, this is a good guy, and then stabs you in the gut right when you finally are like, hey, I kind of like this Eastman guy, and then you get stabbed in the gut, and he's gone. One last point on this episode, not to belabor it too much, but Nick brought up the death of the goat. They don't happen often, but damn if the animal deaths on The Walking Dead are not often more powerful than the human deaths. Because I almost put on that episode from last season or the season before where Shiva, the tiger, dies to save Ezekiel. I mean, I remember that. That was
I'm trying to remember other great animal deaths. Rick's horse.
Horse.
Is that it?
I feel like there's another one.
I feel like there's another one, too.
How has there not been a dog somewhere? I mean, like, that feels too easy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, maybe that's why they haven't done it, but like the animal deaths they've done. I mean, a freaking CGI tiger had me ready to bawl watching it.
Aww.
And I was so sad because, you know, he was a tiger and he saved his owner and all that stuff, and just the emotional impact it would have on Ezekiel. You know, that's kind of really, I guess, the animal death itself is one thing, but also the impact that it will have on the owner. You know, the person that's closest to that animal. So it's a good they don't do it often, but they do it well when they do. Jenny, your number four episode.
Okay, so this one I kept switching back and forth between putting it four and five, but I ended up putting it four. It is the season one, episode one, the pilot episode, Days Gone By. I remember I didn't know about the show, and I was at like a family party, like for Halloween that year or something like that, in late October, and they were talking about the show, and I was like, "What are you talking about?" And they're like, "Oh, the show Walking Dead. Oh my God, you have to watch it." And that first episode was so addicting. It's so many possibilities. Like, you had no idea what happened. You had no idea where this was going to go. And thinking back on it, knowing everything that I know, it makes it even more amazing what they've done. Even though, you know, we don't always agree with it. It's not always great. But from that first episode, the world that they managed to build, and the stories that they've told and the characters that we've loved, it all just stems from that episode. And Rick was so great in it. He was just so confused and had no idea. We were him and he was us. And we were all just, what the fuck is happening? You know, just, it was amazing. I still think it's great. I love it in black and white as well.
Oh, so good. Yeah, the episode in black and white does add something to it. This is a great episode. You know, Nick and I just watched it last year, the year
before.
Was
it last year or the year before? I don't remember. Yeah, but no, it was great.
It holds up exceptionally well. Almost made my list as well. Andrew Lincoln was out of this world right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
He was instantly absorbing. If he hadn't been as good as he was, this show never would have worked, because for the entire first season, Rick is the character. He is the guy that we care about. The other characters are not really fully fleshed out at that time. And he has to carry things. And he carries things so well from the get-go. The usage of the – I remember just – and honestly, going back and watching the first episode in the first season, some of those walkers and zombies they used in that one were creepier than what they would do later on.
Yeah, the bicycle girl.
Bicycle girl. I mean, just –
that's just iconic, like, and creepy as shit.
Morgan's wife is the one I remember.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Morgan's wife, yeah. That's when you get the idea that this show is not going to be for the weak at heart. It's not just going to be zombie blood and guts, because a lot of people love that stuff. It's going to be emotionally draining in a way that, most successful TV shows are not. And so, yeah, you're totally right to put this on your list. It was one of the better tone setters of an episode that I've seen on TV. Nick, your thoughts?
No, yeah, great choice. I mean, like we said, we watched it last year or the year before, whichever, whenever it was. And, you know, this was on my preliminary list of 15 that I had made, so just couldn't make the final cut for me. But great episode nonetheless.
Well, that brings me to my number three selection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to go to what I came to the conclusion is either the best or second best season of The Walking Dead, and that is season three.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that season three and season four are so good, or at least one of the reasons that those two seasons are so good, is the performance of David Morrissey as the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with the episode Dead Weight from season four. I'm sorry, I said season three. Season four and three are governor-heavy seasons, and this is the first of two episodes that involve the governor that will make my list. It's also the second part, really, of a two-episode focus on the governor and what happens to him after his failure at the end of season three. Remember, he's tried to seize the prison, and they rebuffed him. They pushed him back, and the governor has fleed into hiding, and even his most loyal lieutenants have deserted him. And in the episode before this, Live Bait, which also almost made my list, very, very close. I had to choose, actually, between that and this, because I didn't want my list to just be season four episodes, which very easily could have been, because as looking back on it, especially the first half of season four was just unreal good.
Yep.
So Dead Weight makes it, because I mentioned earlier the theme to my list is characters going through change, characters going through thematic changes in their lives. Whether it be Shane transforming into this mentally deranged villain, whether it be Morgan transforming into this peaceful transcendentalist, or in this episode, they've shown us the idea that the governor can find redemption, that even the most evil and selfish of characters in this post-apocalyptic world, that even the worst of us can find redemption, because it looks like he is. The governor has found a new group of people that had no idea who he was, where he came from, what the horrible things that he's done. They just see him as a newcomer who's helping them out to take care of their ailing father. And he joins this family and instantly grows attached to them and eventually grows to love them. Well, Dead Weight is the episode that says a leopard can't change its spots. That when pushed, when things don't go exactly the right way, the governor will always revert back to who and what he is. And it's really a tragic tale, because the governor has everything served up to him to restart his life and kind of fix the things that screwed him up before. But all it takes in this episode are a few things going wrong, a few negative encounters, a few problems with supplies, and suddenly he gets it in his mind that he's got to take the prison. He has to take the prison, because now he needs to protect this new family the way that he had to protect his townspeople before. And so this is the episode that puts it all into perspective, including a scene where the governor is talking to Martinez, his former right-hand man, and he gets him drunk and then brutally murders him and assumes control of the group from him, essentially, and then lays out the plan that they're going to take the prison and allow it as a place for him to raise his new family. Just a powerful episode, a powerful performance from David Morrissey as the governor, because I there was a moment between these two episodes, Live Bait and Dead Weight, that I bought in, and I thought, you know what, maybe they can redeem the governor, even though you kind of know in the back of your head that it's going to go awry, that he's not going to be able to resist the temptation for revenge on Rick and his people, and then how the governor continually justifies it in his mind as not being about revenge but about protecting his new family, when in fact that's all bullshit and it's actually about revenge. It was just brilliantly done. One of my favorite episodes of all time. I was a little bit surprised it didn't end up in my number two spot, but there was one episode I liked even more than this one to put there. So this one comes in at number three, and great performances all across the board from Jose Pablo Cantillo as Cesar Martinez, Kirk Acevedo, Nick, our boy from Arrow, mm-hmm. Richard Dragon, Ricardo Diaz, as Mitch. And of course, Myrick Murphy as the baby, Megan.
Can't forget her.
And among the earliest appearances of Tara. So just a great episode and a great stretch of episodes. I was looking back on it, Nick, and this is actually my favorite sequence of episodes in the history of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's another one that I considered, but didn't wind up ultimately making my list. And for my number three spot, you know, I think there was a lot of speculation on your part, Greg, that I was going to give it, you know, some credence on my list to certain episodes that killed certain characters. And I could not deny it that I understand that this episode was not intended to make me feel unmitigated joy the way it did. But I'm going to go all the way back to season three, and I'm going to go to an episode called Killer Within.
Also my number three.
That's fading.
Now, I must admit here, pause my sarcasm here for a moment. It is a legitimately emotionally affecting episode. Mm-hmm. What plays out over the course of the episode is you have the prison comes under a mysterious assault by a group of walkers. Now, granted, you have other things going on as well. You have some stuff in Woodbury that, quite frankly, is irrelevant as to why it made my list. But so anyway, the prison comes under assault from this group of walkers, and Carl and Lori and Maggie are trying to make their way from one side of the prison to the other, and they find themselves caught in this series of corridors. And wouldn't you know it, there in the middle of it, Lori goes into labor. As the walkers are closing in, she's gushing out blood during the contractions, and Maggie has to make this like terrible decision at Lori's insistence to perform what is essentially going to be a fatal C-section on her. And so Lori gives birth to Judith there as she bleeds out. And then, as much as I hate the kid, the worst thing that could possibly happen to, I think probably the worst thing that's ever happened to any character on the show, as Carl's got to put a bullet between the eyes of his just deceased mother. I mean, it is heartbreaking for him. But I will say, after the first two seasons of the show, fuck Lori, I was glad she was gone.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Ooh, boy. I mean, I just can't imagine, like, that whole sequence is just riveting and like horrifying, and you can't look away and you're freaking out and you can't believe they're doing it. Like, you kind of thought they were going to do it, but like they started doing it and you're like, oh fuck, Maggie's got to cut her open, oh my god, she's going to die, oh my god, she's going to turn in, is the baby going to die, is it going to be a baby zombie, and like you're just freaking out,
and you kept waiting for there to be like some miraculous, you know, saving moment for Lori, like for Herschel to show up miraculously. Yep. And like fix everything or something like
that. Or sacrifice himself.
You're right. And eventually you realize that just wasn't going to happen.
Because it's like episode four of a season is like really odd to lose a major character.
Not just one, but you guys are burying the lead, which is the T-Dog died in the episode.
Yeah.
That's not the lead, Greg.
No, it's really not. But, I mean, poor T-Dog, man. That was rough. But not as rough as Carl having to, you know,
shoot his own mother.
You know what's remarkable about T-Dog? He somehow lasted into the third season.
Yeah. And had absolutely no moment.
And I can't think of one single moment where I go, man, T-Dog was awesome there. Like, not one.
Maybe
he's
his
a
best.
Fan
he was
favorite.
Up there with, like, Martinez. Or not. Who was the guy?
Yeah, yeah. I know you. You're, what was his name? Oh.
What was his name?
What was the guy's name from last year?
Yeah, that they brought back. It was supposed to be some big deal, and we were like, who?
Who? Here we go. Rick's like, I know you.
Yeah. The guy from the camp outside of Atlanta. Yeah.
Who was this guy?
I think it was Martinez.
I thought Martinez was the governor's guy.
Oh, you're right. Oh, shit.
Ramirez, maybe?
You're Ramirez.
Rodriguez?
I don't know.
We're just going to go through every stereotypical Latin American.
I know you. You're Eddie Guerrero.
You're Gonzalez.
Eddie Guerrero.
You're El Rio del Santo.
Morales.
Morales. We got there.
We've gotten there a bit. Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Another thing that this episode had going for it, though, one of the first extended appearances of Axel as well.
So yes.
Axel.
I can't believe that.
One of the great forgotten side characters in Walking Dead lore.
Oh, Jesus.
Who also... The episode didn't make it, even though it was another great... Actually, did it make it? I can't remember what episode this was, but it was another in this great series of season 3 and 4 episodes. Was Axel's in the middle of telling an old-timey story about his family, and he gets killed in the middle.
Yeah, just brutal. Oh, another like devastating part is when Carl comes out, and Maggie's holding the baby, and then he tells Rick, and then, I mean... I lost it. Like, I was sobbing uncontrollably, and Andrew Lincoln...
Carl had, like, that deadpan look on his face,
yes.
You know,
and,
like, just broken.
It spawned, like, a billion memes or whatever, and, like, haha,
yeah,
whatever. I laugh at those memes, but holy shit. His reaction was just fucking amazing.
One of the most conflictingly emotional episodes for me, because it was such a powerful emotional scene, and yet I also felt uproarious joy that Lori was gone, and yet I felt anger at myself that I felt emotional when she died. So I was like, no, you don't like her. Why are you so sad? But it was so good. You're so right about this episode. It was so good, and again, another one that almost made my list. Really, really good. And it continues... You know, I talked about seasons 3 and 4. They're so good. They're so consistently good in 3 and 4. In particular, season 3, there's really not a blip in the radar. They're all good episodes.
Yeah, I mean, all of season 3, and then the first half of season 4,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Up until they finally, once and for all, blow off the governor thing, that's easily, like, the peak of the show. You have better individual episodes that I think we're all going to talk about in a little bit.
Yeah.
But, like... In terms of consistency, it never got to that quality ever.
It was the most consistent show that I was watching at that time. In terms of just not just firing on all.
I don't know.
Cylinders.
Let's see. Season 3 would have been around the same time as like season 2 of Arrow, would it not?
I think. Yeah, you're right. Would that have been 2012? Maybe. Yeah, that would have been about right. Yeah. Somewhere around. Or would that have been season 1 of Arrow? I don't know. Whatever.
I was still living in Decatur whenever Arrow started. I remember that.
But it was just such a great show at this time, and in the midst of all of this, what we're talking about at the prison, all this horrifying stuff at the prison, we're also getting what I loved, which was the patient, slow burn storytelling of the governor as this really this ultimate politician, really right, where he's this guy that has convinced Andrea that he's doing the right things, and that he's out for the good of the people, and that he's a protector that can make sure that she and the others are safe.
Unlike season 7 and 8, it was a slow burn that actually fulfilled its promise.
Paid off in a big way. Yeah, absolutely.
It was a slow burn, but it didn't overstay its welcome. Like, you were fine with it slow burning, unlike season 8, which I would argue just got...
That's what I'm saying. Like, as much as I like Negan, and I like the performance of Jeffrey Dean Morgan a lot... The governor is the best antagonist that the show's ever had because of his story arc.
Because the characters he was bouncing off against, our main cast, were more naive. Like, they were younger characters who hadn't been as hardened by the world yet. I mean, like, Rick against Negan was essentially two guys that were pretty similar. I mean, Negan was a lot more drastic and sadistic in that kind of way. But, I mean, in terms of... their modus operandi and how they go about protecting their group, not that far apart. Whereas the governor and Rick were just two totally different forces, you know, butting up against each other.
And the governor's duplicity made him so interesting, because Negan is Negan no matter who he's around. For better or worse, he's Negan. The governor is somebody completely different when he's with Andrea.
Right.
He's with people of the town than he is behind the scenes.
And that's another great point is, you know, unlike the Negan conflict, we had characters that we knew about or knew previously on both sides. You know, you had Merle and Andrea on the side of the governor at times, then you had all the characters we know of course, on Rick's side. So it was just a great conflict.
Great conflict and a great episode. And whose turn are we at, Nick?
It's up to you. It's your number two.
Ah, my number two. Well, for my number two, I mentioned earlier how great the mid-season finale of season two was. But I've got one even better, in my opinion anyway. And what I have is the season four mid-season finale. This is the climax, the payoff to the Governor storyline. And it's an episode called Too Far Gone.
Mm-hmm.
It is season 4, episode 8, written by a guy named Seth Hoffman, who I don't know how many other episodes he's written for the show, but this one is a masterpiece. It picks right up, actually. It's in part of that, what I think is the best 3-episode stretch in The Walking Dead of Live Bait, Dead Weight, which was my last entry, and then right after Dead Weight, we get to Too Far Gone as the governor launches his one last assault on the prison to try to take it from Rick. And it is relentless. This is an episode that from the first minute never lets up. It is all action. It is all drama. It is something happening every single second of the show, which you can't always say about The Walking Dead. But there, it is just, they have said, we have built this. Imagine that, Nick. You spend a season and a half building a conflict, and then you pay that conflict off in a satisfying manner. We get a real all-out war here. as the governor and his people, to include the unwitting accomplices Lily and Tara, taking on Rick and his crew after having captured Michonne and Herschel. And one of the best scenes in the history of the show happens in this episode, and that is the death of Herschel, because the scene leading up to it is so tense. Herschel has Michonne's katana at the throat of Herschel. I'm sorry, not Herschel. The governor has Michonne's katana at the throat of Herschel, and he is being pleaded with by Rick. And there's that moment from what we've seen in the past few episodes where you wonder, can the governor be reasoned with? Is there still that glimpse of the good man that once was the governor before all of this happened, still deep inside him somewhere? And then with one word, it is clear that he's not, because Rick's telling him everything. Rick is giving him a plan that they can work together, they can live together, they can resolve their differences, a plan that might actually work potentially. And he is using Herschel's advice to him to try to appeal to the humanity of the governor and to put all their issues in the past. But the governor is too far gone, and he says just one simple word, liar. And then he cuts off Herschel's head in a shocking moment, a really, truly shocking moment. And it's heartbreaking and it's shocking, but you don't have time, really, to mourn it, because that's when the shit hits the fan. And the battle begins. It is just it is incredible what happens here. The violence, the chopping off of the head, the Lily and her story. She shows up and then gives the governor the body of her child Megan, who the governor had become to love, who had taken, you know, such an affinity for, and then the governor has to put her down because she's been she's going to turn. She's been bitten, basically, and killed by walkers. And there goes the last – whatever vestige of humanity was left in the governor is gone. And so you're left with this just horrible battle between the sides. The governor has lied to Lily and Tara, and they realize it. And now you get all the people fleeing the prison because the zombies are overtaking the prison. It's a lost cause at this point. The prison cannot be saved. Which did bring me a little bit of joy. Rick kind of had it coming a little bit at this point in the show. Not that I wanted him to die necessarily, but the governor is just beating the life out of Rick, and Michonne impales him. And then you get the as the governor's laying there, left for dead to be consumed by walkers. He's put out of his misery by Lily, who finally shoots him in the head. And then you get that Sodom and Gomorrah ending, right, where Rick and Carl are walking away, and Rick tells Carl, "Don't look back, just keep walking. Don't look back." What a great poetic, violent episode this was. I think this is maybe the best example of a great action-packed episode of The Walking Dead. It's a mid-season finale that lives on in my heart and my mind. And was a fitting finale for a truly terrific villain in the Governor.
Indeed, it was a great episode, and another one that I had to cut from my list, unfortunately. So, a good choice on your part,
and a thrilling recap. Because I had forgotten a lot of that. Honestly, I remember the look on Herschel's face, like Herschel, mm-hmm. He just knew it, and he was just staring at his girls, and you know. It was rough, and I wasn't like super attached to him, but that was their reaction and his, like, you know, it's going to be okay look on his face.
The look that he had accepted it. You know, that, I think that's what did me in the most on that, was like that he knew and he had accepted it and was at peace with it, and there was that unspoken dying words the unspoken dying words that I heard. I don't know if anybody else heard, which were, "You need to talk to your boy."
I wonder if it hurts to get your head chopped off. Or do you, like, you know, do you feel it? Or
I think you would feel it for like a split second, and that would
be it. Yeah, and then that would be it. Yeah, it would probably be a quick death. But see, the problem is I was just reminded, actually, by reading the episode recap, I forgot that it wasn't one smooth cut that knocked his head off. He gets it almost chopped off, and then he's still clinging to life as his neck is spurting blood on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then the governor starts hacking at his neck until it is completely severed. And that's even. I'm pretty sure that hurt like hell.
Yeah,
there's just no way around that.
Damn, poor Herschel.
I know. Good man. A good character that had really won me over by that point. Nick knows that I was soft on Herschel in season two, but
Greg always hates the wizened old conscience of the group. First Dale, and then he hated Herschel later on, and then finally he came around to Herschel.
I love Herschel, did I not?
Yes.
When he lost his leg, he gained a fan in me. Particularly that, I remember that episode when he had to lose a leg. Yeah, he had to lose a leg. Yeah, so he comes in, but he comes in and he's done something.
He must have loved Zach Gowen.
I don't remember what he did exactly, but he comes in and he gets back to the prison, and Daryl goes, "Hell, old man, you a badass!" And then Herschel just looks at him and goes, "I am."
For some reason, you just made Herschel sound like Ian McKellen. I don't. That's okay.
I am. Is that what they say?
I knew that. That's the line. That's always what you go to.
That's always the line. That's the only line. That's the only line that he ever delivered in his career.
Oh, my. In any event, moving on to my number two. You know, the episode you just mentioned, Greg, we said goodbye to Herschel. But the one I'm going to talk about right now is where we said goodbye to one of my favorite characters. Going to season 3, episode 15, entitled "This Sorrowful Life."
My last cutoff.
Mine too.
Yep. This is an episode that deals almost entirely with Merle Dixon. Mm-hmm. The setup of the episode is that basically the governor is offering to end conflicts between the two groups if Rick will simply turn over Michonne. And at first, Rick's going to do it, and then, of course, his conscience gets the better of him. And Merle decides to take action into his own hands and knocks out Rick and is going to take Michonne himself on to the governor to bring into the bloody conflict. And along the way to the meeting spot, to the rendezvous point, Merle, his conscience, finally gets the better of him. Michonne gets him to admit that he isn't as terrible a person as he likes to let on, and that he had never actually killed anybody until he came into the service of the governor, despite his protestations of hardened badassery for his entire life. And he eventually has a change of heart, stops the car they're in, and lets her go. But instead of going back with her, he keeps on going. And it's that point, it's clear he has something in mind. You're not really sure what. And, you know, there we see at the meeting point that the governor has got this ambush set up, and we see the car kind of roll into the front, and they all move on it, and then Merle launches a sneak attack, taking out many of the governor's men and coming for the governor himself. But unfortunately, the governor gets the better of him, actually bites off a couple of his fingers, and then the governor shoots and kills him when Merle refuses to beg for mercy. And of course, he leaves him there intentionally because he knows that eventually Rick and his group is coming, but it isn't Rick who shows up, it's Daryl. And Daryl is there, and he sees the Walker version of Merle and has a complete emotional breakdown, and Daryl kind of loses it and, like, goes nuts on the zombified Merle while as he's bawling his eyes out, essentially. And that's where the episode ends, is with Daryl just shattered by everything that has happened in the episode. And for that, I mean, for the fitting conclusion to the Merle storyline, for its impact on Daryl, that's the reason to make my list. There's other good stuff that goes on. You get the Glenn and Maggie proposal in this episode as well, and you get some intriguing stuff with Rick, you know, trying to take ownership for his failures in leadership for once. But, I mean, primarily, it's the Dixon Brothers stuff that carries this episode over the top for me.
Yeah, this episode was so great, man. I was reading, I was like, how can I get this on my list? I just couldn't put it in my five, but it was my number six. It was one of the best examples of I mentioned earlier, the governor's fake redemption, basically. This was an example before that to show us that redemption was possible in The Walking Dead. Because to this point, I don't know that we had seen a character really be redeemed. Maybe Daryl, you could argue, goes on an arc from season one and has the Wolverine kind of journey that we've talked about in the past. But Merle was a flat-out villain at one point. And no, there's no way to make up for some of the things that he did. But damn if they didn't try in this episode. And it ends up making you care about the death of a character who was a bigot and a loudmouth and a narcissist and pretty much every bad word you could think of. But because of his actions and because of how he tries to change at the end of his life, you feel for him and you feel bad that things are not going to work out for him. And yet, and especially you feel bad for Daryl, who is this character that's gone on this great journey, who has become sort of the linchpin of the group in many ways, from the ultimate loner to the ultimate team player. And to see Norman Reedus give that performance of a character that has really largely been the manliest character in the group, the kind of the rugged badass that's the mountain man, and then to see him vulnerable in a way that he probably had never been asked to be on The Walking Dead to that point. So incredibly vulnerable in that scene and letting out all these emotions on the screen. It was really impressive performance from both he and Michael Rooker as Merle. And just an incredible episode that I'll never forget, certainly. It's one of the best on the show.
Who would have thought that we would have cared about the death of White Yondu?
Right. Thank you, Jenny. I made that joke to Nick on the phone earlier today, White Yondu. and I completely...
No, I knew, like, after that one appearance in season one, when they went back and the handcuffs were empty or whatever, I was like, oh, he's coming back in the future, and it's going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. Because, like, that character in season one was so utterly detestable, and yet you got the impression there was more they could do with him. So I was looking forward to that from the jump.
What episode was it where he had the line about Glenn? I've been struggling to remember which episode.
I think it was episode 3 of season 1, but I could be wrong.
No, it was later than that. It was later than that.
Something about Korean.
Talking about, okay. No, this would have been, yeah, after the fact. This would have been episode, so season 3 sometime.
Chinese boy. And then Daryl goes, he's Korean. Whatever. yeah. God. Just Daryl's disgusted reaction was. Daryl, of all people, who was this ultra-redneck in season one that seemed irredeemable at himself at times, and then by now he's become this – he's completely changed. And then to see Merle come around towards the end, so good, so good. Well, Jenny, what about you? What is your number two selection?
Number two. Okay, so I'm gonna go to season 3, episode 12. It's called Clear.
Oh, yeah, yep.
This was always one of my favorites. I think it's because you finally get to see, because the whole time you've wondered, like, whatever happened to Morgan? Like, did Morgan ever make it to safety? And, like, you know, Morgan was always sort of a question in the back of your mind. And then you finally see Morgan again. Rick, Michonne, and Carl go back to the hometown to get more guns and shit. And then somebody starts firing at them. They find all these, like, traps and booby traps, and the whole town's just been fucked up.
Boobies.
And, you know, he's, like, written Clear all over, you know, spray-painted it all over the town. And you're like, what the fuck has happened? But you find out that it's Morgan and that he's crazy. And he has just had a completely, like, break from reality. He can't do anything but kill zombies. Like, he just can't process anything other than that. Lenny James, like you said before, is just tremendous. Like, just heartbreaking and wonderful. And the way that he talks to Rick and tries to, like, make him understand how he sees things now so earnestly, but also just fucking dead inside, you know? And Rick just being so touched by it and, like, affected by it and trying to talk him into coming back with them, you know?
And how hard Rick wants to fight for him after all this, because how important it is for Rick. That walkie-talkie had been a recurring part of the show since the first episode.
And it just so – because you knew that, you know, you knew his situation – well, he had to tell him about his son – and what happened with him, and it was just that episode, one of the early ones that have just stuck with me, even through everything. Even when Morgan came back, you know, as much as I liked seeing him be Jedi Morgan and then kind of back to badass Morgan again, to me, the Morgan in Clear is the most broken one, and the one that always sticks with me.
Great stuff. Yeah, this is another outstanding episode. Morgan is a character that I've made no secret that he's one of my favorites on the show from the beginning, from the very first episode. And this episode, I remember how shocking it was, because I always thought that Morgan was going to come back, but I did not imagine that they would bring him back in a way that was going to pretty much undo all that optimism that Rick's had since that first episode, when he's wanted so badly to reach out to find Morgan and to bring him back to their group, you know, to save him the way that Morgan helped save him.
I always just sort of, like, imagined Morgan, like, finding a community, like being a leader in a community, and, like, maybe, you know, finding out what happened. Like, for some reason in my mind, I associated him with, like, figuring out everything. And then to see him like that was like, oh, shit. I was totally wrong about all of that.
And from what I understand, they finally did make him the leader of a community, because now he's basically, like, the lead character on Fear the Walking Dead, from what I understand.
Yes.
I don't watch it.
Yes. I like I've said, he was almost enough to get me to start watching Fear the Walking Dead before other stuff came on. But yeah, he's great. And
I have heard that you could pick up with just the more like the point when Morgan enters the show, because fairly quickly they transition away from all the other characters and and make the show about him.
Yeah,
but you can argue I have not done that yet.
A wise move.
I mean, like, well, I haven't watched the show, so I can't. You know, I watched, what was it, the first half of the first season, and it was fine, so I can't really, like, knock those characters too much. Maybe there are people who were passionate about them, so I don't know.
And then, just a little side on that episode as well, you know, the little Michonne and Carl go looking for a crib, kind of, but he goes to the bar and gets the picture of his mom and dad, but it's a really nice, like, bonding with Michonne and Carl. Early on in their relationship.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that happened that early on. Actually, I was thinking that was a later episode, but you're right. The thing about, seeing Michonne's development was really cool. This is one of the first steps in humanizing Michonne, too, from just the badass warrior woman into her learning to trust other people and to love other people and taking on this motherly role to fill the empty space in her life from her own backstory that we would find out. So good stuff. Mm-hmm. Good stuff all around here. And now we reach the end of our lists. And before I get into it, are any of us diverging from...
Nope. No. Not a chance.
From the episode I'm about to mention.
I'm sure we all have the same episode.
There's not a chance.
So the number one episode for all of us is, of course, the season one episode Vatos, where a Latino street gang takes.
Oh no! I thought you were going to say the season eight finale. My bad.
No, of course, our actual episode is season four, episode 14, known as The Grove. Or, as it's colloquially known, look at the flowers. we're all picking it as number one, so let's just have a freewheeling conversation. This is if you haven't seen this episode of The Walking Dead, you've got to see it.
This is an episode of The Walking Dead that you don't even have to, like, enjoy the show, I don't think, to find something in this episode to like. Because, really, it doesn't move that much forward in terms of the overall narrative of the larger narrative of the show, and it doesn't even really feature characters for the most part that we had grown that much to care about. Now, Carol, obviously we all care about Carol. I'm not saying that, but like Tyrese is in the episode, and Tyrese in the show was a character that never really, to me, hit the way everybody kept saying he was supposed to, given his profile in the comics. Mm-hmm. And the two little girl characters, they had just been introduced in season four. Like, we had not really been given a chance to you know, grow attached to them too much, other than to know that one of them was fucked in the head for like hell. But I mean, this is really as close to like a standalone episode, I think, as The Walking Dead has ever produced. And yet, narratively, in terms of the things it does with its plot, no other show on television would have done something as dark and as daring as this did. I mean, it is, without question to me, far and away, like, the creative storytelling, like, peak of the show, and it has never been approached.
It's the ballsiest episode they've ever done. Yep. It is the most depressing episode they've ever done. It is the darkest episode. It's as dark as anything that was in True Detective, which was an HBO series, and went into some dark places. This is as dark or darker. It is as dark and depressing as any episode of any TV show that I've ever seen. One of those episodes of TV that you watch and you know that everyone is going to be talking about it the next day. Everybody. I remember going into work the next morning, and we were almost traumatized. We always had a Monday morning Walking Dead discussion. And as usually would wait till the afternoon when we had gotten our actual work done. But I remember we got in, and I remember my editor, my boss, Kendall Clinton, looked at me when I walked into the office. I was a little late, as I often was in those days. And he says, all right, Greg's here. Everybody, conference room now. So we went into the conference room. Kendall shut the door. And he said, "What the hell was that?" And so we just talked about it and almost had a group therapy session for about 45 minutes talking about that episode and what an experience it was, that we couldn't believe that a TV show went there, that, you know, the moral ramifications of it, the no matter what you had seen on The Walking Dead, we had seen people eating other human beings, we had seen guts ripped out, we had seen children have to shoot their own mother. We had seen so many horrific things. Friends turned against friends. Family members turned against family members. When you see a little girl murder her sister with a smile on her face, It was as disturbing as anything I've ever seen. And okay, there's a lot of praise to go to this episode. The writing from Scott Gimple. The directing from a guy named Michael Satrazimis. I'll call him the director. All that's great. Everything, the way the shots are set up is great. The performances from Melissa McBride as Carol in particular, it will wreck you. And then credit to, what's her name, Brighton Sharbino as Lizzie. Outstanding. I remember when Nick and I talking about this after the episode aired, just to each other, that I don't remember on television a better performance by a child ever. Ooh. I don't remember one on a TV show, like one that convinced me to this level that I didn't see an actor. I saw a crazy kid that was genuinely mentally disturbed. But what do you do with someone who is that mentally disturbed in a world where there is no health care, there is certainly no mental health care, there is no provision to take care of someone whose worldview is so distorted and so shaped? There's no medication for her, there's nothing, there's no therapy for her. What do you do? And Carol is faced with that horrible, horrible decision that she has to take out someone that she's grown to see as a daughter, a potential replacement in her life for what she lost with Sophia. It's really powerful stuff.
It's hurting my heart just listening to you talk about it. I'm just like, oh my God, I want to watch it again, but also I do not. Like, it's rough. It's so good. It just, ugh. Because they find this little idyllic cabin, you know, and It looks like a great place, you know, and Tyrese is there and he's taking care of the children as well. You know, he's doing his part, and, you know, it just looks like maybe there's some peace to be found eventually, because they're all of our characters are scattered at this point. They're all separated. So it's like, well, I mean, they found this place. Maybe they should just stay there.
Yeah, maybe this is a way to let them have a happy ending and kind of write them out of the show. Because It felt at this point, it kind of felt at this point in the show like Carol's character had gone on her journey, like Tyrese's character had gone on his journey. It kind of felt like there was a chance for them to have a happy ending here. The show, as it often does, dangled that hope of something good happening for us. Mm-hmm. But never has it hurt so badly to have it ripped away.
Just awful. And you knew that there was something wrong with her. Like, gradually, you had figured it out. And you'd seen her feeding the zombies, the rats and shit. And, like, just all these little pieces. And then, oh boy. It's just devastating.
Poor little Mika.
Yeah. I still can't believe they did it.
Yeah,
it's
shocking.
That was like 4 years ago, and I still can't believe they did it.
And when Lizzie's standing there with the blood and just the smile,
you thought she was going to kill the baby, too.
Right.
And she said that. She said she was going to.
She was
going to
kill the baby, yeah. Oh, my Jesus.
Tyrese gets, you know, it was – and the character of Tyrese, who's one of the best people in the Walking Dead group, just a genuinely good person in a world full of bad people, and just he can't even process what's happening. Mm-mm. He can't even understand, can't grasp the concept this could happen.
And that's the other thing is in this episode, you also get Carol admitting to Tyrese that killed his girlfriend.
Yep. Oh, my God, yep.
So it's like this whole deal of, like, Tyrese is having to deal with all these horrors that he just can't possibly understand.
And ultimately, the way that Tyrese processes that is even touching in its own way, mm-hmm. because it's not what you think it's going to be, because he was within his rights to murder her right there.
Yeah, she offered it to him.
She almost wants him to.
Yeah, she kind of does.
And he doesn't. And that, in a way, hurts in and of itself, just from a different kind of emotional, like, my gosh, what a good dude, you know? But ultimately, they're rewarded with this... rewarded, quote unquote, with this horrible scenario. It's if you haven't watched this episode, watch it. You may only want to watch it once, but you need to watch this episode. I kind of wanted to watch it, to your point, Jenny.
Yeah.
We did this episode, but I just ran out of time, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, having dredged mm-hmm. up the memories, just because it's such a, I mean, it is a stone cold classic. Mm-hmm. But man,
Carol's resolve in doing what she did, I mean, as much as we've called her a badass, there's just nothing that she's done that's more fucking badass than that. And like,
no,
and so it, heartbreaking.
As much as I talked about the vulnerability that Norman Reedus showed as Daryl at the end of that one episode, take that to the nth degree here with Carol. And the tears coming out of her eyes, just... Mm. Naturally occurring tears coming out of her eyes as she's doing this. I could imagine being in that scene and what Melissa McBride was tapping into to perform in that manner. She had to be realizing it. She had to be, you know, contextualizing it for herself. Mm-hmm. And gosh, how do you even go to that place? You know, like, so good.
She's amazing.
Yep. Well, anything else to add, Nick, to the Grove?
No. Great episode. It's far and away the best in the show's history. Like, the gap between that one and the others on my list was pretty massive. Like, it would be up there in terms of, like, one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen. So, mm-hmm. like, it, you know.
Same. Yeah, you know, same.
It is what it is.
Well, that brings us, of course, to the end of our countdown. We have gone through a fun reminiscing about a lot of really sad things. So it's kind of been fun to emotionally torture ourselves again. But let's remind everyone of our complete lists. I'll start. I had at number 5, Save the Last One. I had at number 4, Here's Not Here. I had at number 3, Dead Weight. I had at number 2, Too Far Gone. And I had at number 1, The Grove. Nick?
Yeah, I had at 5, Pretty Much Dead Already. At 4, I had Here's Not Here. At 3, I had Killer Within. At 2, I had This Sorrowful Life, which could also be called This Sucky Depression Life. And at number 1, I had The Grove.
And Jenny?
Number 5, I had Pretty Much Dead Already. 4, Days Gone By. Number 3, Killer Within. Number 2, Clear. And number 1, The Grove.
Excellent work all around, lady and gentleman.
You know, doing this, because, like, you guys have talked about it, and we've all talked about the decline of the show, mm-hmm. and, like, what are they doing, and are we gonna watch this, and, like, we're dreading Walking Dead month, but, like, doing this, it makes me super sad, because... Fuck, we used to be all about this, and this used to be good, and I miss it. Like, mm-hmm. why can't they fix it? Is it unfixable? Like, is it too far gone?
I don't know.
I had 15 episodes on my preliminary list. 12 of those were from season 4 or earlier. Only 3 episodes from the last 4 years of the show that I even considered. Hmm.
I had a few more than that, I think. I had,
well, you, like, also had a list of like 40 you were picking from.
True. I had well, 20-something, 24, 25. But I had a lot from I didn't have a lot. But yeah, to your point, the vast majority of mine were seasons 3 and 4 with a healthy bit of 2 and a couple from 6 as well, but and 7.
Yeah, but 6 and 7 I had 6 and 7 were the only two seasons I had any – like any from the most recent years that I considered. I didn't have any from season 5 or none from season 8.
To answer your question, Jenny, I don't know if it's unfixable. I don't, and yet I say that, and I don't know what it would take to fix it at this point.
I don't either.
You can't keep retreading the same ground with these characters. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Like, first of all, the characters definitely need to be continued to be taken in different and new directions, but different and new doesn't mean from point A to B, back to A, and back to B mm-hmm. again. How many times, we brought up Morgan earlier, how many times have we seen Carol go from, all right, she's a hardened badass who's going to protect her group no matter what, to, all right, now she wants to go off and just be left alone. Now she's back with the group and is the hardened badass protector again. Now she wants to be left alone again. They've gone back and forth on that same character dynamic mm-hmm. for Carol at least three or four times to this point, just in the last three seasons.
What about
alone.
Rick, the main character of the show?
Is he
a pacifist? Is he a mm-hmm. warmonger? What is he? And why is he both of those things during the course of one season? And that's the other thing is the show has, in the last couple seasons in particular, the last four or five seasons, the show has really struggled with nuance on these characters. Mm. Whereas in the early seasons, there were a lot of shades of gray. You know, Shane was a bad guy, but Shane had motivation for what he was doing, and Shane wasn't a mustache twirler that was just out to, you know, for power or gain or whatever. The governor was a bad guy 100%, but the governor had nuance. The governor had elements to him. Rick had nuance to his character. Now he just flip-flops between, I'm going to kill you, Negan. I will kill you, to, I don't have to kill you, Negan. That's not the right thing. We don't have to kill each other.
Another thing that I think has actually hurt the show are the time jumps. Not because the time jumps are a bad idea from a plot perspective, but because the writers use them as an excuse for lazy writing. Mm-hmm. They use them as an excuse to have characters come back from mid-season breaks or season breaks completely differently than they did beforehand, and they can hand-wave it away and go, oh, well, they were affected by all these things that happened while you weren't, you know, here, while we weren't showing you this. Whereas before, it used to be you'd pick up one season straight into the next, and you would have to follow these characters along and see their development. Now, with every time they do a time jump, I feel like they're just using this magic reset button for some of these characters, and it winds up feeling hollow as a result.
We talk about character arcs. Arcs are called that for a reason. They start, they go up, and they end up in another place, in an arc. Daryl had one of my favorite arcs of a character. It's the classic Wolverine and the X-Men arc. He comes in as this gruff loner that's antagonistic, and then over the course of the seasons, the first three to four seasons, he goes on this journey and he winds up finding his humanity and becoming the ultimate team player until they decide to revert him back to the crazed loner that wants to kill everybody. Until he then overcomes that and becomes the Daryl we all know and love and back to the team player until he's back to being the crazed loner again that wants to destroy Negan at all costs. So, like, there are room to tell stories where Daryl wants to kill someone at all costs, but you can't just jump from point A to point B back to point A, as you said, Nick. You have to have a journey to get there, and they skip the journey on these things, and that has been a huge issue. And then the other aspect is, I think one of the, in the argument of it's not fixable, would be it's hard to do what we're talking about to a degree when there's no end in sight to the story you're telling. Robert Kirkman has no ending for The Walking Dead from everything we know, and there's no destination in sight, in other words. But I do think that, to Nick's point, maybe it is salvageable, but you have to fundamentally change your approach. You can't take the shortcuts that they were taking. Because I'm like you, Jenny. I went on kind of a – I was kind of bummed out looking at these episodes today when I was trying to formulate my list, because I was like, The Walking Dead was a cultural event in a mm-hmm. lot of ways. Like, workplace discussions, mm-hmm. online forums, there were Facebook discussions that would have 170 comments after an episode, you know?
People would get legit fucking pissed off if they got spoiled on that shit.
Absolutely.
Like, they would avoid social media until they watched it, just so mm-hmm. they would get spoiled on that show.
And it's not anymore, and that sucks. And, you know, I don't know. What do you think, Nick? Is it fixable?
I don't think so. Not at this point. I mean, like, at a certain point, we see this all the time with a lot of things, Greg, whether it's comics or wrestling or whatever. When you have an audience and you do something to lose a portion of that audience, you can win a portion of that audience back, but a part of that that you've lost is gone forever. They're never coming back no matter what. And I think the last 3 years have eroded the audience to such a degree. Now, it's granted, it still gets a ton of people to watch. I'm not saying that, but it is far and away. It's a long way away from like the highest rated thing in the history of cable like it was, you know, 3-4 years ago. And a lot of those people just aren't coming back no matter what you do. So when you talk about saving it, like, can it get creatively better? Sure, it can. But is it going to be what it once was in terms of the cultural phenomenon? No, that was a moment in time that we'll never relive, at least in terms of this show. And their whole idea of the Walking Dead universe that they're trying to do now is 5 years too late. Like, now you are beating the dead horse that is this property. Not saying it's completely dead, but they're beating a dying horse. How about that?
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we've seen in the last few years, you think, why have people kind of been driven away? There are a lot of reasons you could point to. Everything that we've talked about with the character development, the kind of running in place on plots and not developing. When you only have 16 episodes, there's really no excuse to move at such a glacial pace that almost nothing happens seemingly during the course of a half season.
To be fair, the show has never been a fast, what I would call a fast-paced show.
No. But what I'm saying is, when you have a story that you're trying to tell, you still have to develop that story. So the Governor story took a year and a half to tell, but there weren't episodes where nothing of import was happening to these characters. Whereas now, there seemingly are episodes where things just happen that are dull and uninteresting and drag. It feels like artificially dragging a story out.
And to get to a certain point, let's not forget that the first 4 seasons of the show were not almost entirely built around audience manipulation.
Oh, I was going to get there, yeah.
Like, because, I mean, that's a gimmick that can work, but you can only use it once or twice. And when you use it over and over again, it's not sustainable.
Fool me once, shame on you. Right. Fool me twice, you don't get fooled again. Right. So, yeah, that's a huge issue with that. The Walking Dead, at times, is a show that feels like it has contempt for its audience. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is,
because going all the way back to, like, even season 4, which we agree was probably, like, the last great season of The Walking Dead, that season ends. Like, they're building up to this Terminus thing, and it literally ends with them just being put into a box.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Which, cliffhangers are one thing, but, like, you have built to something for 7 episodes, and you give us nothing. Like,
well, yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I thought that they had a chance, talk about creatively saving the show, with this past season. Okay, all-out war. You know where you're going now, finally. We know that we're going to at least finally get this conflict with Negan. You just cannot fail to deliver in the way that they did 2 years in a row with the Negan stuff. And to finally get to the big conflict.
Well, you could make the argument 3 years in a row.
Yeah, you could. You could make that argument.
Because, yeah, it was the end of season 6, right, that was
where they're all lined up in the circle.
They're all lined up, and then the end of season 7 is just Rick going, oh, it's on now, or whatever the hell.
But it wasn't. And you can't have a promise to the audience where Rick literally makes a point out of almost an entire episode of telling Negan, I'm going to kill you, when this is all said and done. From the very beginning of this story, Rick tells Negan, I'm going to kill you. That is the arc. That is any storytelling that you've ever experienced in film or comics or books tells you that at some point that's going to come back around, and either Rick's going to die trying, or he's going to get that moment where he finally gets Negan, and it's going to be this cathartic moment for the audience.
And I'm sorry, but like, as I said before, all of a sudden, pacifist Carl is not enough justification for Rick not killing him.
No.
Because that wasn't a belief. That was another example of, like, Carl just off-screen became a pacifist, like, in between seasons 7 and 8.
So let's – you posed a very interesting question here, Jenny, so I want to pose a question to you. What would it take for you to get you emotionally vested in the way that you were three or four seasons ago? Or is it possible?
I don't know. Like, I want to say, well, with what we know, Andrew Lincoln leaving the show. Okay. Maggie's leaving the show. Why am I going to watch this? Like, Michonne, yes, I do love her, but, and part of me wants to watch her grieve for Rick, because God fucking God, they have to kill him, right?
I would not be surprised at all if they just literally let him ride off into the sunset or something stupid like that.
I would set my fucking house on fire.
It would be the most non-Walking Dead thing ever. And I'm not, I don't say that in a good way. I say that in terms of make no sense whatsoever. But there's a part of me that wouldn't be surprised by that.
Well,
or maybe he like literally just dies of like disease or something, like in a non-violent way or something.
Just awful. And
turns out I had emphysema.
As much as I love Negan, and I don't want to see him like locked
no
up.
No time, you know, for babyface Negan. That, no time.
I don't know. Part of me goes, well, maybe, and then part of me goes, you've learned this lesson before, Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it. Honestly, I don't know.
Maybe if they make it the Carol and Daryl show.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they have sex.
Close there, Greg.
Can,
close.
Can they have
there it
sex?
Was. There it was, Jenny. I've been waiting the whole time we've known each other as Walking Dead fans. I know you have been among the most vociferous Carol and Daryl need to bang each other people.
If they will do that shit, I will watch that show. If they can promise me that.
It's not the Daryl and Carol show we need. It's the Daryl and Eugene show. That's what we need.
Nick.
Well, they can
Nick's
have sex too if they want to. I don't care, but I need
more
sex.
No, no. They just get in the car and they drive off together and they go on wacky buddy cop adventures across the country.
Nick, in his head, has actually plotted out a 16 episode season of The Walking Dead that will save the show.
It's just Daryl and like Eugene riding down the road, and Eugene is just monologuing about God knows what, and Daryl's just staring at him like the entire time, like trying to figure out what the fuck he's talking about. Entire show. It's 16 episodes of that.
By the end of the season, it's like the very first scene in Sling Blade. Where Daryl's just making noises as Eugene regales him.
Imagine
clearly
that.
Wants to be anywhere else but that car. No, I think I still watch the show. I still will watch the premiere and see what happens. But you know, it will take. They can't start this season like they started last season.
You are also one of those people who you tend to think that just. Getting rid of Rick is magically going to solve these writing issues.
No. I never thought that it would magically solve the writing issues. I wanted them to get rid of Rick because I felt like they had written him in such a way that it was at the expense of other characters. In other words, it was all about Rick and his plans. It was all about other people telling us how great Rick is, which is what the comic book is. And I got no time for that.
About to have some time for it.
So I was like, I do think that getting him off the board has characteristics not unlike.
Listen,
a show that could lose some of its laziness in terms of I long ago thought that The Walking Dead graduated beyond being a show about Rick Grimes. I thought they should have embraced being an ensemble show because I did care about Rick, but I cared just as much about Carol and just as much about Maggie and Daryl and even Glenn and Eugene and Abraham and all these other characters, Sasha. So the ensemble is the strength of the show, but yet it always comes back to being the Rick Grimes hour. And for me, I had kind of he hasn't been the most interesting character to me for a long time. So yeah, I'm a little excited about that, but I'm also it's not going to matter if they just turn that into Daryl or if
I was about to say, as much as we all love Daryl, how long does it take before The Walking Dead becomes the Daryl Dixon hour,
mm-hmm.
and we're all annoyed by that?
Mm-hmm.
Sure,
Yeah, it's the
like that's my biggest concern, you know? Is they're going to take like our universally beloved favorite character and ruin him by making him the lead.
Right. And and I think making him the lead is the quote unquote. But again, why does the show even need a lead?
Because writers are lazy and they fall into formulas and they think that people are too stupid to follow something without a lead.
Right.
And I read an article today that Norman Reedus is like, I will do this show for the rest of my life.
There you go.
Sure.
So why the hell?
Yeah, because AMC lets him make his shitty reality show about riding motorcycles across the country.
I mean,
he's apparently having the time of his life doing this show.
I'm sure he is.
I would keep doing it too.
I'm gonna task you guys with this. You don't have to do it tonight, but like eventually over Walking Dead month, I need you to fantasy book Rick's death. So one of these weeks, y'all hook that up.
That will be a nice distraction, probably from the comic book episode, which I don't think we'll have much to say about, Nick.
There you go.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I have to give that some thought.
I got it.
You have to pay it off in a satifying manner.
Rick and Michonne are trying to get it on. Rick can't get it up, so he goes to see Eugene for some medical help, thinking that Eugene can probably fix him up with some sort of drug or something to help him get his boner back. And Eugene's just standing there, and it literally lulls Rick into a stupor, and a zombie just walks up and bites him on the neck, and Eugene kind of shrugs and walks away, and that's the end of it.
And then he explains the death to Michonne when she asks him where Rick is, and he explains it in a Eugene manner. He's like, what happened was he got in a bad way and ended up in the deceased.
Now listen, Eugene is not Carl. He did not get – he got in a bad way. Come on now.
He hooked him up a little stob and –
he was looking for some blue chew, and I didn't have any.
Well, he's now in the deceased column.
Eugene could make blue chew if he needed to. I have no doubt in my mind.
That's what we need more of is
Eugene and his harem that Negan blessed him with.
An individual named Eric Bischoff taught this to me. Actually, that's a lie. I do not know an Eric Bischoff.
All right.
Anyway, yeah, so we'll get on that, Jenny. But yeah, good discussion here. And you can hear more interesting discussions like that on Jenny's podcast, Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Drive-In, and various other appearances she makes throughout the Place to Be Nation universe. Jenny, tell us what you've got on deck and tell the people out there how they can reach you via social media.
Y'all, in the 7-day span between Sunday and Sunday, I will have recorded 5 podcasts this week. So, I mean, literally just anywhere.
oil on those chains.
Yeah, I know, right?
Looking forward to hearing you on Between the Sheets.
Yes, I'm lubed up and just riding that bike wherever. Anybody will have me. But seriously, I'm on Twitter, Jenny Cruz 2814. I'm in the Place to Be Nation Comics group. Geek and Sassy has a page on Facebook and Twitter, just Geek and Sassy.
Follow them both.
I think that's it.
Very good, very good. Yes, follow those pages she mentioned, Geek and Sassy on Facebook and Twitter. Follow Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. We have a lot of good discussion there, or at least some good discussion there. Mm-hmm. And we do have PTBN Comics on Twitter. Mm-hmm. We do have – I am at G Phillips 8652. He is at Nick Duke 87. You can contact us through our lonely Twitter – or email addresses, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. He loves the D. And
who doesn't?
You can also find us on Facebook with a friend request, although we probably won't accept it. But you can.
I don't know who you are. I'm probably not accepting your friend request. I've been burned one too many times on that front. That's all I have to say.
Yes, I agree. But you can also slide into our DMs. And Jenny, I know that goes for you as well.
No comment.
Very good. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got reading, we've got watching, we've got the rundown, and we've got a little listener reaction to last week's show. Stay tuned. I know you will.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Kimball here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Walking Dead month is off to a stellar start, Nick. I have to say, I am pleasantly surprised by how the tenor of this month is going to this point.
Indeed.
Granted, we're talking about mostly the good things from The Walking Dead so far, but still, you know, we had some good, you know, criticisms there to throw in as well of the show, and I had a great conversation in the first half. Thanks to our guest, Jenny Smith, for that. But now, before we get into the rundown, before we get into reading, before we even get into watching, I wanted to bring to you, as I sometimes do and often forget, a little bit of listener feedback to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last week, we, as we always do with Countdown, since the beginning of our show, for the record, we always solicit lists from our listeners. If you have lists that you want to put out about our Countdown topics, we want to hear them. And sometimes we get a lot, sometimes we get none. This time, Nick, I have to say, we probably got as many listener lists submitted as I can remember in quite some time.
Yeah, it was a good feedback. I was very pleased with it.
Now, I'm not going to be able to get everyone's on here because I don't know if any of you have noticed, but trying to sort through Twitter notifications can be very difficult, particularly if there's no hashtag to go along with the list. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the ones that I can find and give shouts out to various people. Let's start off with a friend of the show, Nick.
Let's start off with a friend of the show. Sounds good.
A very good friend of the show, mm-hmm. in fact. A dear, close, personal, long-time friend.
Yes.
Ben
Morse. Esteemed Ben Morse, yes.
Absolutely. He has a list. He first of all, he put the show over. He said it was an excellent episode. And he also submitted a list of his own, mm-hmm. of his top five introductory comics,
mm-hmm.
to give to other people.
Mm-hmm.
At number five, he has Runaways, Volume 1, a book that neither of us have read, Nick.
No, neither of us, no.
Number four, he has Flash, Born to Run, also a book that neither of us have read, I
yep.
think.
Nope.
But one that we can add to our list, thanks to DCU, I believe.
maybe.
Number three, Ultimate Spider-Man, Volume 1. Mm-hmm. Pretty fair, decent choice.
Decent
there.
Choice.
Number two, Batman Year 1. Yet another pretty fair, decent choice.
And having it must number two on the list is decent.
Must have been a smart man to put the best introductory comic on his list, granted at number two.
Yeah, number two. Or somebody
and
else
then at
it.
Number one, he has another book, stop me if you've heard this before, that neither of us have read. And it's by our old friend Kurt Busiek.
Mm-hmm.
Marvels.
Mm-hmm.
Number one on his introductory comic.
Well, you know what's said, great? You know what's great about Marvels? Unlike Flash, Born to Run, I can say with 100% certainty that if I wanted to read it right now using an online subscription service,
subscription
I could do that.
Service.
I know I could do that, but can't say the same for Flash, Born to Run.
Although you might.
I might be able to at any given moment, depending on the whims of someone.
Now, could you have read Marvel's when Marvel Unlimited first launched, though?
I don't know that.
I don't know that either. But nonetheless, Kurt Busiek, Alex Ross, what's not to love? Well, you know, we've been accused, though, now, Nick. We've been accused of an anti-Busiek bias.
Well, I'm assuming that Busiek has more in his arsenal than just Silver Age nostalgia, so I'll have to see at some point.
I appreciate that, Nick. I appreciate what you did there, by the way, surreptitiously burying him once more. We will get to that at some point. It's been requested. We always try to fulfill listener requests. Now, let's move on to our old pal, Geek and Eats on Twitter. Of course, Twitter handle is at
Al28. I love Geek and Eats. What a hell! That's a hell of a handle there.
I do like that. He is at Hal2814, longtime buddy and friend of the show. Mm-hmm. His list, he didn't actually order them in 5-1, but I'm going to assume it's top to bottom, so I'm going to read it from the bottom up. Silver Surfer, the Mobius two-part story by Real Stan Lee, at The Real Stan Lee. You might have heard of him, Nick. He was a famous writer at one time.
Some guy did some stuff.
Yep. At number four, Day Tripper, a book that I remember coming out but don't know much about. Number three, X-Men Dark Phoenix Saga, appropriately
for
enough.
For new readers, interesting.
Number two, JLA, The New Frontier.
Oh, yeah. That's honestly probably a huge – that's a blank on my part. That definitely should have been on my list. Good call.
Yep. And then at number one, he has Batman Year One by Miller and Mazzucchelli.
Yep.
Let me see if I had any other on Twitter that I can find easily without going through too much of a struggle here. I'm gonna leave Twitter behind because it's just a mess of GIFs and political garbage. So let me go to Facebook. We got a listener, well, friend of the show and other Place to Be Nation host, Russell Sellers, has his own list that he submitted. Number five, Wonder Woman Year One. Number four, Beasts of Burden. Number three, Southern Bastards. Definitely would agree with that one. Jason Aaron and Jason Latou. Number two, Batman Hush, which as we talked about on the show last week, oddly for a book that does include continuity ties, has a 100% conversion rate for me to hooking comic book fans. And then at number one, Saga, which I obviously is a great choice. And then one more before we move on to the rundown. We've got Sean Kidd, who's a Place to Be Nation newfound listener of the show, actually. Mm-hmm. Here's his list. At number five, Batman Hush. At number four, Green Arrow Quiver. Very interesting.
For a new reader,
Yeah, number three, the Wolverine limited series from 1982, Miller and Claremont. Yeah, I mean that's a stone cold classic. Number two, X-Men Dark Phoenix Saga. Second time we've seen that pop up on a listener list, Nick. Interesting. And at number one, Batman the Long Halloween. Interesting.
That's pretty. Yeah, I mean,
do you think that works as a standalone?
I think so. Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of telling a younger Batman story, and like the origin is one of those things I think that's kind of just accepted. You know,
everyone knows it
at this point. You know, and it tells its own story. So, I agree.
I think it works. I think it works, and maybe a little bit of an oversight on my part as well. But
I think we were thinking origin, and so we went with the most classically defined version, but that's
yes, right. And one that probably relies less on preconceived notion. I think you have to at least have a cursory understanding of who Batman is,
right? And at least probably some of his other villains as well. It helps to know who the Joker is and Poison.
Have a little bit, because the book plays with your expectations to a degree,
right? Right.
Very, very good. So thanks a lot, guys. We love listener feedback. We'll try to give you a shout-out on the show if you give us some listener feedback.
Especially again, if you're giving feedback on our Mark Wills discussion. So that's always good.
Oh, absolutely. We got a lot of great responses to our Mark Wills discussion on Twitter in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike, our good friend Mike on Twitter, was a big fan, it seemed, of our 15-minute Mark Wills diversion.
Oh, how could that be?
So, you know, we if you have any feedback to the show, give it to us. We won't be able to get to everyone because it's just hard to keep up on especially on Twitter feedback. We do our best, but we would love to get feedback from you and call you, give you a shout out on the show. Mm-hmm. So let us know what you think. Well, with that being said, let's get to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment we call The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
So, kicking things off, Nick, lots of news revolving around the upcoming X-Men Dark Phoenix movie, appropriately enough for our recent discussion, which is not going to be called X-Men Dark Phoenix, but just mm-hmm. Dark Phoenix. Mm-hmm. It was originally going to come out in February, but now the release date has been shifted into June, I believe. Right, Nick?
I think that's what we saw, yeah. I'll be honest, I don't have it pulled up right here in front of me, and after seeing that trailer, I am not filled with any great amount of give-a-shit about this movie. So
yes, it's been moved from February 14th to June 7th, 2019. And the very first teaser trailer released, and...
This is another. I think we've brought this up before. At what point is a trailer no longer a teaser trailer? Like, right. What exactly is the distinction between a teaser and a teaser trailer? Because this was like a 2-minute and 20-second trailer, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. What do you want from me? I didn't come up with the nomenclature.
I'm just saying.
But I think my reaction to the trailer was, it's all right. It's all right.
And again. As I said about, what was the last movie?
Apocalypse.
No, not Apocalypse. Or there was another movie recently where, like, I brought up Venom? The point that if the trailers just make you go, not a good sign. I mean, with a superhero movie, especially with a freaking Dark Phoenix movie, if you can't cut a trailer, then it shows me some moments, at least, that just makes me, you know, go, oh my god, that looks awesome. What are you doing here? What are you doing?
Yeah, they focused way too much on the tropes of the X-Men movie franchise at this point. You have to have a long shot of Magneto crying, or at least a brief shot, sorry, of Magneto crying, because mm-hmm. he's the Karen Page of the X-Men movie trailers. You have to have a shot of Professor Xavier shouting ominously, "Eric, don't! Don't do this, Eric!" I believe every trailer going back to First Class has had that, by the way. And you have to have a shot of the group divided into two different groups where friends are squaring off against friends. You have to have a shot in the trailer of Mystique threatening to walk away. Am I missing anything here, Nick?
I don't know. Just the whole thing.
I'm a fan of the X-Men movies. I'm a fan of what Fox has done with the X-Men movies. I'll own that. I've been much higher on the franchise than a lot of people are, but
I think the franchise
gotta give me something more when you're promising Dark Phoenix. You gotta make me think that this is not gonna be like The Last Stand was, and instead right. I came away from this trailer thinking, damn, that looks just like The Last Stand.
Yeah, I think. In terms of the franchise, I'm not down on what Fox has done with it by any stretch of the imagination. I'm down on like individual entries. Like I think Last Stand, obviously, and X-Men Origins Wolverines
are atrocious,
flat out terrible movies. And I think X-Men First Class is a solid movie that is one of, if not the most overrated superhero movie ever, but a fine movie in its own right. And then Apocalypse is where you and I differ, whereas I think Apocalypse was just okay, and you're higher on it than I am.
Yeah, I liked it because but I acknowledge its flaws. It was not by any means was it a quote traditional. It was a quote good movie, but what it was a fun, entertaining nostalgia fest for me, and I can acknowledge that it was pure nostalgia for me. But
and this to me looks like more of continuing more of that trend from Apocalypse, which is concerning.
Well, I would even argue against that, though, because I didn't get any nostalgia feelings from this trailer. I got a sense of retreading old ground from this trailer.
And not really bringing anything. Like, that's the thing. If you're going to do this again after having already done it in Last Stand, which I know was 12 years ago. God, 12 years ago. But if you're going to do it again, you have to do it in such a different, in a different enough way to distinguish it. And it just kind of feels like they're doing Last Stand again. Like, I understand you've got the Jessica Chastain character who may or may not turn out to be Lilandra or, you know, other, you know, fan theories out there for various characters or whatnot, but the basic setup of it seems to be the same, you know. Young Jean Grey had her mind manipulated by Professor Xavier. Now the Phoenix is loose and she's mad at Xavier. That's basically the premise, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we didn't get any glimpse of the space stuff. We didn't get any glimpse of Gladiator or any of the cool characters from the Imperial Starfleet and everything. The Armada and all that crap. I don't know. It's hard. It was. I didn't think it was. I didn't think anything looked bad in the trailer. I just thought, uninteresting.
Nothing that happened in that trailer, other than seeing Fassbender as Magneto again, made me want to go watch this movie. And no question, I'll go watch it, because again, it's Fassbender as Magneto.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, I'll go watch it, and absolutely, I'm not going to completely condemn it for one bad trailer, but I will say it seemed... It may end up being like The Walking Dead, where the acting is great across the board, and the story is just predictable and retreading old ground, like we talked about earlier.
And long term, it's not going to matter that much, because this is without question the last time Fox is going to get to make one of these.
Yeah, and I really hope they don't end on a cliffhanger. That would be very...
I think they've had enough lead time with reshoots and whatnot that they know they can't end on a cliffhanger, because Disney is coming and they're taking over.
Do you think there's a part, just a part, of Simon Kinberg, who's been kind of one of the steering people of this franchise for so long, that regrets going to the Magneto well so many times, now that he knows he's not going to get any more cracks at it, probably?
I don't think so, because really they haven't let that prevent them from doing other villains per se, because the last like four movies they've used Magneto almost as like a uneasy ally of the X-Men, you know?
True, although he ends up kind of being the villain at the end of Days of Future Past. Like
at the very end of Days of Future Past, true. But that was really set up about Bolivar Trask and the Sentinels and stuff.
Right.
And at First Class it was Shaw and the Hellfire Club, and then you had Apocalypse, so...
And he joins Apocalypse for a portion of that movie, doesn't he? If I remember correctly, I can't remember.
He's one of the four horsemen, yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of sorry,
it's him, Archangel,
Storm,
and Psylocke.
Psylocke, yep.
Which I'm not familiar with the four horsemen from the comics, so but I don't think that's ever been a four horsemen.
Not a singular group, but the thing is, it does. They've always drawn in members of the X-Men to the Horsemen, whether it was Angel was, I guess, the first one who became Archangel, and then you had Gambit join them later on. I think Cyclops joined them briefly. Wolverine joined them at one point when he was Feral Wolverine, I think.
And didn't they tease Sinister for some movie?
They teased him in Days of Future Past, I think, in the because at the very end of the movie, remember they retrieve Wolverine's DNA from after he's escaped.
The SX Corporation.
And it has the SX Corporation in it, yep.
Okay. So that's really the only, like, I mean, and granted, you're a bigger X-Men fan than I am, so you could probably name some, but, like, if I'm thinking of the main X-Men villains off the top of my head, I'm thinking, like, Sabretooth, you know, Magneto, Bolivar Trask, Juggernaut, Sentinels, Hellfire Club. I mean, other than Sinister, I'm struggling to think of big ones they haven't hit on yet.
Well, you know, you could hit Mojo is a big one that they haven't done.
You certainly could. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, I'd be for it, but you know.
Mojo, who's an out there villain, no doubt, but I think they could do it. You had you know, not necessarily major villains, but the Brood would be a villain group. The Marauders.
You already got a version of the Reavers in Logan.
True. And a very good version at that. So you've already gotten Lady Deathstrike. Mm-hmm. Who else could they pull?
So I guess it doesn't really matter. My general point is that the perception that
Strife. Oh my gosh! If we ever got Strife,
the perception that they've only used Magneto, I think, is a little bit inaccurate, and I think people bang on it too much. For me, anyway.
Get it on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move on from the X-Men, and let's voyage into the Spider-Verse, Nick. Mm-hmm. Because a new trailer has dropped just today as we're recording this.
No, it was a couple days ago.
And by that I mean just a couple days ago, before we were recording this, of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the Miles Morales-led animated feature from Sony. And we've talked in the past about, you know, I was very kind of hesitant about this movie. The animation style at first that we saw in the early teasers wasn't, you know, didn't really appeal to me. This trailer was awesome.
You know what was cool about this trailer, in addition to so many other things? The varied animation styles. Like, Spider-Ham has his own distinct animation style. Spider-Man Noir has his own animation style. I'm not actually expecting it to happen, but if the 90s animated series Spider-Man pops up in this movie for a second, I'm going to lose my shit in the theater. That would be amazing.
100%.
Yep. Like, and now that they've done this, like now that I've seen the trailer, now I just want the old 60s animated Spider-Man to pop up for just a cameo or something. I want every version ever just thrown into this movie.
And he kind of dropped it in there, but we found out that Spider-Ham is going to be in this movie, which I didn't know about before this trailer.
Yeah, I actually did know that because they had announced that John Mulaney was going to be voicing him. So,
That's perfect.
And Nicolas Cage is voicing Spider-Man Noir. I'm trying to remember some of the other ones. Haley Steinfeld is voicing Gwen Stacy. And then I'm trying to remember the other guy who's voicing Peter Parker that I can't remember.
He's great, whoever he is. Yeah. This trailer really has everything that you look for out of a Spider-Man property. It has family, it has intrigue,
Jake Johnson is voicing.
It puts the hero in peril, and it has that signature Spider-Man humor. Across
Lee Schreiber is voicing Kingpin.
Oh, very good. I thought that was Kingpin in the trailer.
And Mahershala Ali is voicing the Prowler, Miles' uncle.
Is he the modern-day Mahershala?
He is Cottonmouth.
Right, I knew that. But is he the modern-day Mahershala, do you think?
I don't give any credence to any Jinder Mahal references.
Oh, my. You need a... Well, never mind. You just need to say Ashanti, Nick. That's what you need to do. But nonetheless, there it is. Ashanti.
Ashanti, wasn't she an R&B singer?
I believe she was, yes, sir. I love this. And I am, you know, we differ on this. We talked about Spider-Man Homecoming, and I'm a big fan of Tom Holland, but I'm not as into the Spider-Man stories they're telling in the MCU right now, even though I enjoyed the movie. Not really, it's not setting my world on fire the way that it is for you and a lot of other people. I love this take on Peter Parker. I love him. I love getting to see an older veteran, kind of grizzled Peter Parker that still has the Parker humor, has a little bit of an ego about him, and leaning heavily into being a New Yorker. Really, really love this version of Peter and him playing the mentor figure to Miles, who is just going to be a breath of fresh air to me. I've realized I'm kind of over high school Peter Parker, and high school Miles is kind of going to fill that void and giving me an older Pete. It looks so good, and it makes me wonder, Nick, why Sony never tried something like this in their live-action Spider-Man movies.
Well, to be fair, Miles Morales wasn't really a thing until they had already bungled their Spider-Man franchise, you know, into the ground. That's a fairly... Miles Morales, let's see, would have been created in 2011? Something like that? And that would have been, like, mid-production of Amazing Spider-Man 2, and there was no coming back from that colossal blunder. So,
would it have been? That would have been on the first Amazing Spider-Man, wasn't it?
Amazing Spider-Man 2 came out in
14.
Did it?
Right?
I thought it came out in... I don't know. The point remains, they were so deep into their Amazing Spider-Man series of blunders that I don't think anybody really knew. And plus, Miles Morales' creation and his kind of catching on as a character aren't really... You know, there's no way to know for sure that he was going to hit it hit it huge
the way that he did.
He did, and he really has. Yeah, 2011. I had that right. August of 11. So his solo series would have launched in like late 2011. Yeah, this looks awesome. I like how you say you're over High School Peter Parker, even though we've literally had one movie actually exploring that. But
No. We had Spider-Man 1. We had the Amazing Spider-Man.
He was in high school for all of like 20 minutes of that movie. I don't want to don't even give me Spider-Man 1. He literally graduates in the first like 20 minutes of the movie. It has nothing to do with high school. High school.
I don't care about high school. Is he a high schooler? That's what I mean.
In the most technical
teenage
of senses.
Peter Parker. I'm over teenage Peter Parker. Are you happy now?
No, I'm not happy. I'm not happy. I'm never happy when you have such trash opinions on these fine airwaves.
Not a trash opinion.
You subject them. Fine listeners to your bullshit, doo-doo shit, fuck shit, junk opinions.
Oh, he gets picked on in high school. Oh, he's in love with the girl next door 700 times over. Give me something different. Give me something else.
I got a good hook to him. I got a great hook.
Comic.
What if we take him and we have, let's say, the Rhino, since he's Russian, shoot him in the head and ruin everything about his character? That'll make people want to read him, right?
I think you just need to give it a chance and let it play out, Nick.
I think you do. In any event, no, this looks awesome. I was already going to see this because, one, it's a Miles Morales movie and I was going to support it for that. Two, mm-hmm. It's an animated movie, so it's something I can take my kids to and not mm-hmm. have to leave them at home. But the fact that this actually looks awesome in addition to that is just an added bonus on top. So,
and both of us, it's interesting, Nick, because both of us have been skeptical of the Spider-Verse concept in the comics.
Right.
Why do you think that we're kind of embracing this to such a degree?
I was excited about it just because it was going to be a Miles animated movie. You know, and I felt like there was an opportunity to give that character a higher profile. The Spider-Verse aspect of it I was unsure about, but seeing how they're doing it. I mean, like, something, like I said earlier, as simple as each character kind of having their own distinct animation style and then being blended together, it just looks like a really unique take on it. I think perhaps it's, we fantasy booked and dreamed about a DC crisis for so long that anything that approximates that speaks to us in some way, and this kind of feels like that, at least to a certain degree.
Yeah. I was going to say, I brought that up to my boss earlier. We were talking about how this is probably one of the most DC things that Marvel's ever done in terms mm-hmm. of a concept. Because, you know, everybody points out when DC Marvelizes their characters, but nobody really points out when it goes the other way. And in this case, it's definitely a DC kind of concept, and it works in this mm-hmm. context. I mean, it shouldn't, but it does. And I guess that in the comics, I'm less open to it for some reason. But seeing it in animated form, maybe you're right, Nick. Maybe the fact that we just haven't seen this done before kind of...
And it's brilliant on their, you know, from a marketing standpoint. Because, I mean, think about it. Like, you're going to have Peter Parker toys to sell alongside Gwen Stacy toys, to sell alongside Miles Morales toys. Think about all the demographics you just spoke to with just those three characters alone, let alone whoever else could wind up being in the movie. Because I don't
Spider-Man Noir, who I don't know anything about. But.
Spider-Man Noir is just a one note. I mean, it's essentially they printed a line of Marvel comics called Marvel Noir that was exactly what it sounds like. It was Marvel comics that were set in like the 40s that were all like detective gangster stories that de-emphasized the superheroics and stuff. Of it.
I wish that Nicolas Cage would give him a 40s gangster voice.
But. We'll have to see. You know, we haven't seen it. We only got like one line, so we'll see what the finished product winds up looking like. But no, I'm pumped for this. This looks awesome.
Well, we also got some announcements coming out of the DC Universe app, and namely their Harley Quinn show. We got Harley Quinn officially announced as being voiced by Kaylee Cuoco. Cuoco from that show, Big Bang Theory, mm-hmm. and she's going to be voicing Harley Quinn. We also got a clip from the show, a true teaser clip, mm-hmm. Nick, not a trailer, but a teaser clip here.
And this looks awesome.
And it was phenomenal.
This looks awesome.
You want to talk about surprised?
Yes.
Of all the stuff we've just talked about, this was the biggest surprise to me because I'll be honest, I wasn't looking forward to this show at all, and now I am because it looks awesome.
Yeah, I mean, the humor in the 30 seconds, like, taking DC to task for, you know, their predilection for dark and gritty entertainment, especially considering this is going to be a DC Universe exclusive show that is being launched, its first, you know, original bit of programming is Titans, which we've all derided for seemingly being so dark and gritty based on the trailers. So yeah, this looks awesome. A nice little dig at the unproduced FX Deadpool show, also thrown in there, was nice. And their deadpan, disinterested version of Poison Ivy has already won me over. I want her in every episode.
Yeah, looks great. Can't wait for this to happen. And then a show that I'm going to be talking about a little bit later, we also got an announcement of the related to the sci-fi show Krypton, or if you prefer, Nick, Krypton.
Mm-hmm.
We have found out that let me see. I got to find this announcement so I can make sure I get the actor's name. The main man is coming to Krypton, basically. Mm-hmm. An actor by the name of Emmett J. Scanlon. That guy, who has played Jim Corrigan on Constantine, and he was a prison guard in Guardians of the Galaxy. He has been cast as Lobo on Krypton. He will be appearing in the second season of the show. I am so pumped for this, Nick. You just don't even know. I can't wait for you to watch the first season of Krypton at some point. This show's aesthetic, they're dynamic. I'm curious how they're going to pull this off. But I don't have any reason to doubt the producers of this show at this point. So I'm really excited about this. The first live-action Lobo of all time, to my knowledge.
They better not give us New 52 Lobo.
Oh, I didn't even think about that possibility, Nick. Surely not. That feels like an abandoned project at this point. Hopefully not. Damn it. I want jacked up 90s caricature Lobo. That's what I want. The main man. Guy that says Fragger all the time. And Bastich.
Hopefully you'll get exactly what you want.
Well, one thing that I really never wanted is the casting of one Rosie Perez.
He had to remind me who this person even was.
She has been cast as Renee Montoya, according to The Wrap, in the Birds of Prey movie. Perez is best known for her roles in Do the Right Thing and in the one that I know her from, White Men Can't Jump. Also won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress, or was nominated for Fearless, a movie I haven't seen. She will join Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn, Journey Smollett-Bell's Black Canary, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead's Huntress. So I'm totally cool with seeing an older veteran cop, Renee Montoya. No issues there.
Yeah,
it's just,
no, that's fine. Especially because we know they're going a little younger for the birds, sure, themselves.
It sounds good.
It kind of,
yeah,
makes a little bit of sense, I guess,
it
from
does.
The standpoint
it does.
Of the movie.
Absolutely, it makes sense. And Renee Montoya is a little bit of an older character. But I think the issue for me is that all I can remember about Rosie Perez is from when I was a kid and her really annoying voice in White Men Can't Jump. And it just keeps coming to my mind that that's what we're going to get with Renee Montoya. And I'm sure she's not going to play it that way, but that's just what's popping up in my mind. I'm sure I'm being unfair here to Rosie Perez, basing her on one role in one movie that I remember her from. But, man, when I first saw that, you were on the phone, we were on the line when we were in the L-shaped studio, I should say, Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, mm-hmm, when I heard this news for the first time, and I was like, oh, God, Rosie Perez. But maybe it'll be better than I'm imagining.
Probably not, but we'll see.
Yeah, it is DC-related, and it relates,
yeah,
to a movie.
Like as you know, other than Wonder Woman, all the benefit of all the doubt is gone at this point.
Yeah, by the way, Amazing Spider-Man 2 released May 2nd, 2014. So,
2014, yeah.
Anyway, well, that's it for the rundown. How about that? A pretty short edition of the rundown. So let's not waste any more time. Let's move on to a segment in which we discuss books that we've been reading, shows that we've been watching,
mm-hmm,
games we've been playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a segment called Reading and Watching.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and Watching. What have you been reading and watching?
And Nate, before we get into this, I have to share this with you. As I was looking for user comments or listener comments on Facebook, I see on the side here a link to a group called Aw Yeah Comics. And the group photo is a bunch of Simpsons characters as traditional Spider-Man villains. And I had to share this with you because you've got Homer as the Kingpin, you've got Professor Frink as Doc Ock, and then here's the perfect one though. Mr. Burns as the Vulture. It just works. So, have you been reading anything, Nick?
No.
I have, believe it or not.
Oh, God.
I have read this past week Doomsday Clock number 6. Mm-hmm. Now, number 7 has released, and I've started on it, but I haven't finished it yet. I will just say that what I've read of issue 7, phenomenal. Maybe the best beginning to an issue yet in the series. Issue 6 is it's a little bit of a slowdown issue in that it is all about the origin, or not all, but mostly about the origin of the Mime and the Marionette. Two great new characters that Geoff Johns introduced that we've talked about on the show, Nick, back seemingly 10 years ago when Doomsday Clock started. But it's a very good issue. Their origin is a vintage Geoff Johns kind of tragic origin. It's really, really good. Really well done. The quote League of Villainy, which is kind of an intentionally corny name that is referenced in here, meetup of villains is pretty fun here as well. The Joker is amazing in this. Just completely nonplussed by anything that goes on around him. You get to see some of the Watchmen character, or one of the Watchmen characters pop up in this one as well in a big bad way. I don't want to spoil it because I know you haven't read it yet, Nick. But you're gonna like this one when you read it, I'm sure, although it's very much setting up things to come later. And again, the supplementary material was as interesting to me as anything in the actual book. I really think Johns is doing a phenomenal job with these seemingly unrelated supplemental things. And of course, Gary Frank is putting in the best work of his career. So Doomsday Clock continues to kick ass.
Awesome. Good to hear.
And watching. You been watching anything, Nick?
Yeah, I watched a little bit more of Luke Cage Season 2.
Bushmaster.
That has, of course, featured more of the Bushmaster, which has been good. I've enjoyed it so far. I can't say it's hit the highs of Season 1 yet, but I get the impression, just by the way it seems they're pacing things out, I'm not anticipating the massive drop-off that we got in Season 1. It seems like they're trying to play the long game and tell one story rather than setting you up for the big switch. Now, if they do the switch, and by all means it could be bad, but we'll see. Thus far, I'm enjoying it.
Excellent. Good to hear that, Nick. I know you were not super excited about that going in, so I'm glad to hear you're enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to watch it to see how it's going. They're doing an interesting thing where they're trying to, it seems like they're isolating Luke more this season from his traditional support structure, and I'm sure they're going to bring it all back by the end of the season, but Claire has left him for the time being, sorry, and anyway, I'm just getting into spoiler territory, I apologize.
That's all right. Very good stuff there, Nick, and I have also been watching something. I have finally, after been starting watching it a few months ago, I have finished the first season of Krypton on Sci-Fi Channel. Marlon Brando's favorite show, Krypton. Mm-hmm. And holy crap, did it deliver a phenomenal finale. I had to refresh myself a little bit on what had happened in the prior episode. They did a great job with a recap at the beginning that took care of that. Wow. I don't want to spoil anything for people that haven't seen it yet. Find it if you can. It's kind of streaming in different places. Like, you can find it, you know, it's hard to find all the episodes in one place right now, but see if you can get a hold of it and watch it, because, gosh, it would be pushing Legends as my favorite comic book show of the past season. You know, there may be, you know, obviously the back half of Arrow I thought was great,
But this Krypton show has just blown me out of the water with the character development, with the way it's made me care about these characters I wouldn't have expected to going in, the way that I've changed my perceptions about these characters over the course of the season, and the ending, the last probably 10 to 15 minutes of this episode are as shocking as any season finale I can remember on a comic book show for a long time. I mean, just shock after shock, and ending in a completely unexpected, almost a dread-filling ending, where it's like you don't see any way for a positive outcome. It's so good, it's so bold, and I love the show.
I'm glad to hear that. It is on my list to catch up with at some point, which means it'll probably never happen.
Maybe after football season, right, Nick?
Maybe after football season. I would say that I will probably watch Krypton season one about the same time that you will finally play Arkham Knight. How about that?
Okay. Well, aren't you gonna feel like a realistic damn feel if I start playing Arkham Knight right when we get off this call, which I won't. But if I did.
If you did. In this hypothetical fantasy world that you've created.
Hypothetically speaking, it's like a Tennessee Williams version of Conrad.
I was like, what is that?
Hypothetically speaking.
Oh, God. I haven't done that in a while.
I take my thumb and my forefinger and I put my glasses between them and I twist like this. Nah.
Connie.
Connie, my boy.
Those cheeks.
Anyway, round cheeks, Connie. Anyway, what about playing? Have you been playing anything, Nick?
No.
I know you have, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, I replayed Batman Arkham Asylum and part of Batman Arkham City, but no need to spend the listeners' time on that. Those games are years old at this point.
Absolutely. Almost as old as the comics that I need to read. So, that brings us to the end of that, and now we've got, you know, we've talked about Walking Dead month, we've got some other things ahead of you. At some point this month, mm-hmm. we are going to attempt to read another volume of The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. Two volumes, in fact, according to our list. We'll see if that happens.
It's a quick, easy read.
It is. There's one could argue not. That's because nothing really happens, but no, things do happen. They just happen randomly. And then there is, what else are we doing this month, Nick? What am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing something this month.
We're going to talk a little Telltale, a little Walking Dead Season 2.
Oh, yeah, Walking Dead Season 2. Yeah, that'll be fun. Now, that's another, you know, see, people say that we're cynical, Nick, at times about things, but we are focusing on the positives of The Walking Dead this month, largely.
Yeah, except for the comic, which is never positive.
Right.
Or maybe it becomes positive. I've never gotten this far before.
Right, maybe
I've
it does.
I've never been this far before. which jogged my memory, Greg. I recalled what that I reached back through the alcohol-fueled haze, and I recalled what that segment was that I was gonna start introducing.
What is it?
Well, we're going to close the show with it. Don't worry about it.
Oh, all right. So anyway, we've got that. We've got, and of course, we're going to close the month out as we always do with a premiere, a review of the premiere of the Walking Dead this season. And you can all hopefully look forward to that. Mm-hmm. So, with all that being said, I can only help but look at the clock, Nick.
Oh God, here we go.
There's a minute on that there clock. Oh, I'm sorry. There's a minute on the clock in the studio of the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all
Place Speed Nation.
I got you off guard with that one. Didn't
that
I?
It was so ham fisted, it made me laugh.
Spider ham fisted.
Yeah, there you go.
So there's a minute on the clock, Nick. Uh-huh. It can only be time for the wrestling minute.
Okay.
You haven't watched any wrestling this
I
week.
Haven't, because I've been sick for the better part of a week, both on either side of the weekend. So I've watched nothing, so I have nothing to offer here other than vague and that sort of thing.
Gotcha. Well, I will say that Raw emanated from some city that did fine as a crowd. Seattle, I think. They did a good job. Not as good as Denver last week, which was out of this world. But Seattle did a good job as a crowd. Three good matches from the Shield guys. Mm-hmm. Ambrose and Strowman, shockingly good chemistry. Roman and Ziggler, good chemistry. Seth and McIntyre, amazing chemistry in that match. Phenomenal. SmackDown Live last night was, as from the one we were recording, was great as usual. Just good stuff from beginning to end for the most part. Super into all the storylines they're having there. The Rusev thing was funny. Entertaining stuff all around. Watched a little bit of the New Japan show on Sunday. Just a little bit, but the Young Bucks had another stellar title match against the Guerrillas of Destiny. I don't want to spoil the result for anyone of that match. A great match. And then even better than that was Will Ospreay versus Marty, as JR calls him, Cheryl, in the Junior Heavyweight Championship Tournament was amazing. It was probably my favorite Will Ospreay match that I've seen, which covers a ton of ground. It was amazing. I can't say enough about it. JR and Kevin Kelly on the call were great. Friend of Place to Be Nation, Kevin Kelly. Great stuff. Looking forward to watching the whole broadcast this Friday night on Access.
Awesome. And speaking of JR, we're actually going to... JR is going to play a role here, Greg, in our new. I don't know how often we'll do this, but periodically, whenever
I didn't know he was here in the studio.
I get the whimsy. JR is here, and you know every podcast needs a little musical interlude to let us go. So, welcome to our newest recurring segment, JR Sings the Hits, and I right now have just handed Jim Ross some lyrics, and here we go, folks. Listen as JR serenades us out the door.
All right. Let me see, Mr. Ross. Are you ready? Up, oh, he says he's warming up in the corner. Hold on. I'm Slobberknocker. Marty Sherrill. He said he could call him Okada. You are my fire, the one desire. Believe when I say. I want it that way. But we are two worlds apart. Can't reach to you your heart when you say that I want it that way. Tell me why ain't nothing but a heartache. Tell me why ain't nothing but a mistake. Tell me why I never want to hear you say I want it that way. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen,